Okay. Welcome to Public Policy 19290, Introduction to Homeland Security. This is an interesting experiment, I hope. I hope an enjoyable one. On campus, we're going to have major contributions from faculty in the Public Policy School, in EECS, and in the TRUST Collaboration, which is a computer security collaboration here at UC Berkeley. We're also going to have large participation from people at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. A couple of them will probably drop by later this evening. One of them is a co-instructor in the course. They are probably the leading people on the face of the planet about weapons of mass destruction kinds of issues. So you will hear from the very best people that anybody can provide. We also have co-instructors from UC San Diego in the computer science department, experts in computer security. Also University of Washington, computer science, computer security. And finally, the class will be shown on the Microsoft campus. And so I can tell you based on last year's course that we will have very strong students there with a lot of expertise, and it should be a very interesting discussion. Our philosophy in Homeland Security is that there are people with many different disciplines who should be talking to each other. Now, of course, they always have, but we understand in public policy, and people in computer science departments understand, and people at Livermore understand, that we really can't do this subject with just whatever I happen to know in one of those institutions. We have to talk to each other. And frankly, even if you weren't here, we would be talking to each other. That's what the purpose of this course is. It's an occasion for all these institutions to work together and to see what they can figure out, pooling their knowledge. And so you get to be party to that discussion. And I'm glad that we're doing the course, but it's a necessary thing just for the research agenda of those institutions, and I think it's very exciting to be a part of that. All right. Couple of things about mechanics. I would like, to the maximum extent possible, to keep class discussion for the break. We will have a 15-minute break in the middle of this evening and toward the end of the last section of the course. That's not entirely necessary right now because we only have one class online. It gets very difficult to have class discussion with multiple classrooms. The technology is very good, but I can tell you, having stood up here trying to make out questions, it's not that perfect yet. Also, this lecture will be archived. And so it's really frustrating to somebody who's listening to this on the web to have inaudible questions and then me responding in a kind of incomprehensible way. So what I'd like to do is, if I become incomprehensible at some point in the evening, you've got to ask me the question. If you've got something that's an interesting comment or a sidelight or something you'd like to explore, write it down and let's go into it. The other thing that will happen, which it turns out to be a very nice experiment, is we have a thing which you all are probably familiar with called a wiki, a shared page, where everybody can log on and continue class discussion. And that's a really natural way for people at the four campuses that are participating to interact. So I not only encourage you to, after each lecture, get on the wiki, I also encourage you for the more mercenary reason that that's part of the class grade, that your participation and the quality of your participation are how we evaluate you in this course. Okay. So let me make a few preliminary comments.
Hey, Steve.
As I just said, Homeland Security is inherently interdisciplinary, and students sometimes have some trouble sorting out how you put together the engineering side of the house, the physical science sorts of things that come into a course on Homeland Security, and the social science. And so I have this cartoon for you, which may be embarrassingly simple. All I can say in defense of it is it's the way I think about it. So this is what economists call a production possibility frontier. But basically the idea is, say I'm making software. I now remember this system. Say I'm making software. What I'd like to do is, there may be two things that I want that software to do. I want it to be convenient to users, and I want it to be secure. And what engineers are taught to do, what engineering departments are all about, what scientists are all about, is if you're a very smart person and you have all the goodwill in the world, you can't make software that's better than some combination of security and convenience. And this black line here shows that trade-off. That's what human beings know how to do in principle. And engineering is all about pushing that frontier out to make us have the best possible combination of security and convenience. But social scientists say, yeah, that's fine, but you never actually get there. Because unless you're all by yourself, you're working in groups. And groups, some people don't want to work so hard, some people have different motives. There are all sorts of reasons why human beings never get out to that theoretical frontier. And so in this course, repeatedly, we're going to go back and forth between what's technologically possible, which is this frontier out here, and human factors. And sometimes the thing that's going to be most important is, gee, we just don't know how to make a certain kind of physical object, a detector for nuclear weapons. We just don't know how to do this thing. And in that world, the technology is going to dominate. On the other hand, other times, we're going to have a situation where, in theory, we know how to do something. We know how to do really strong encryption. But getting individual human beings to do that, or getting individual human beings to write really secure software, even if we know how to do it, may not happen because we can't arrange the incentives in a convincing way. So that's the mental picture I want you to keep in this course. We're going to flip back and forth from time to time, and you have to keep straight that, first of all, some things we just don't know how to do, and other things, yeah, we know how to do them in principle, but there's still a big issue about organizing human beings so that they actually do it. And we're going to go back and forth, but when I say this is an interdisciplinary course, those are the two lenses we'll be looking at. And just to give you some examples, it was very fashionable in the 1990s to say, oh, gee, I can put encryption on a T-shirt, so why do we have these silly export controls? And lo and behold, when we have Al-Qaeda and terrorism, you know, they had a guy who was supposed to take care of encryption for them. They did a really bad job, and not only can the NSA break into their computers when we find them, but the Wall Street Journal can. Okay? So human factors do matter. I'm not making any judgment about, you know, what export control should be about, but it's just wrong to say that because I can put it on a T-shirt and smart engineers somewhere can do it, that, gee, that's all I need to think about. I need to think about, would it have been dangerous if Microsoft, say, had gone ahead and made this really user-friendly? The world would have been different. So this is the kind of interplay. And one other example, there was, after 9/11, as you all recall, endless discussion about all the people who thought maybe they saw this coming, who imagined that somebody might want to fly airliners into buildings. And Richard Clark, to his credit, said, well, I have this memo where I said, gee, the terrorists could load a bunch of explosives onto an airplane and fly it into a building. And that was a very prescient thing. He's proud of that. He should be. But if he'd known more about the physics of fuel explosions, which the Pentagon, by the way, has known since the 1970s, he would have known that explosives are sort of superfluous, that if you have a lot of kerosene and you aerosolize it, that's even better than explosives. Rich Mueller, who's a physicist here at Cal, we'll probably talk about that in his lecture. But my point is that Clark's imagination was a little limited because he didn't know the physics of the problem. And at the same time, the FAA also had this thought, but they quickly dismissed it because they said, well, gee, flying airplanes into buildings doesn't allow you to negotiate. And we all know hijackers like to negotiate, right? Well, the FAA had a great technical understanding of this threat, but they dismissed it because they didn't have a social science understanding that, gosh, there are lots of goals that you try and accomplish with terrorism, and negotiation is just one of them, and maybe it's not the one that's most realistic for our adversaries. So you have to keep looking at this subject through both lenses, or you keep stumbling. Finally, I want to make a disclaimer. The fact is we are all, or most of us, somewhat sentimental about some terrorists. The best examples I can think of are there were terrorists who killed Nazis, and there were terrorists in 19th century Russia, which was a very miserable place, we'll talk about them this evening, who were the most decent folk you could imagine. I mean, maybe not, but close. We all sort of have that. I am not going to get into the question of the ethics of terrorism particularly, because I have no special expertise in it. We're going to deal with it as a tactic, as a strategy, as a social phenomenon, and we can all debate sort of in the breaks or after class, you know, whether, gee, we should cut this organization or that organization a break, or alternatively, whether a terrorist is a terrorist is a terrorist. But those are things that we have, as social scientists, no particular expertise in. I mean, I would be sort of going into the territory where Meryl Streep starts talking about apples and stuff. She has no particular expertise in that kind of regulation, and I have no particular expertise in ethics. I'm just a citizen in that regard. But I think I have something to share with you in the social science side of the house, so that's what we're going to do. Okay, mechanics. We are going to, the main requirement in the course, all this will be fleshed out more in the website, but the main requirements of the course is we're going to ask you to form teams, which will probably include computer scientists at the other campuses, to produce a joint white paper. And the way it usually works is that individuals will take responsibility for a chapter, but we don't want this to be a staple job. Everybody will work on everybody else's chapter to produce some sort of whole. And the idea of the white paper is, I don't want a simple book report from you. I don't want to hear your opinions about things necessarily. I want you to do what a public policy bureaucrat would do, or an analyst, let's be kinder, and to think through the problem for his boss, and to tell his boss, this is the salient facts you need to know about the problem, dispassionately, neutrally. These are the choices you have, the options. And heck, I know you have your own ideology and you answer to your own political party, but here are your choices, as clearly as I can make them. And occasionally when you write that white paper, you will come to the conclusion that no sane person would do anything but choice A, and if that's true, good for you, say it. But the point is, I want you to imagine that you are giving advice to someone who will ultimately bring all his own values and prejudices and biases to the table, but you want him to make the best quality decision you can. And that's what the purpose of the white paper is for. Around the time of the midterm, there will probably also be a team exercise. We're working on that with the other schools. Probably it will involve hacking into a computer somewhere, which we will set up for that express purpose. And we will try and hang enough social science issues on it that you can say, well, here's what I learned from the exercise, and here's how I generalize those vulnerabilities to some problem of interest for purposes of terrorism. But your instructors are still working on that. It's under construction. Finally, I guess I mentioned people do sign up for the wiki. I'll show you the URL in a minute. Come to class and do participate in the wiki. That's how we, you know, if you have a white paper chapter that, gosh, it looks pretty good, but you sort of fell down, that's your insurance, because I will go back to the wiki and look and see if you've been contributing and the quality of your contributions. And it's a nice way, as I say, to interact with people at the other schools and also with your instructors. Okay, so broad outline of the course. I imagine you've seen the syllabus. The first part of the course is going to be about terrorism. Tonight we'll talk about the history of terrorism. Next time we'll talk about Al-Qaeda seems to be doing something that's a little different from traditional terrorists. They claim, and it's a pretty convincing claim, that they think they're conducting warfare. Is that a sensible thing for a terrorist organization to be doing? How do you think about that? We will do that sort of thing, and Dean Nacht will, on the third week of the course, talk about non-proliferation issues, weapons of mass destruction, keeping them out of the hands of terrorists. After that, we will have a long segment with our co-instructor from Lawrence Livermore Laboratory about weapons of mass destruction. As I say, we'll have leading experts both from the Cal campus and from LLNL. And finally, we will have a segment of the course on cybersecurity with these computer science course professors both here on the Berkeley campus and at UCSD and the University of Washington, really unraveling what's that topic about. How does that fit into the terrorism picture? And also, how does it fit into just the general, we want to secure computers for the economy? Why deterring cybercrime is an interesting thing, and we'll go into that. So that's the general structure of the course. This is the course website. I'll put it up at the break again if your finger isn't quite fast enough. But it is very important we are going to sort of abandon telebears. at this point. UW will maintain the website, and it's important that you know the website, check the website, and particularly sign up for the email list, because you just won't get any email otherwise from us. You won't know what's going on in the course, and especially register for the wiki. And historically, we've had some technical snafus, so go home and try it. Make sure that it accepts you, and if not, ping me, and we'll straighten it out. Finally, Dean Nacht has a conflict, and he will be coming in not on the Wednesday night schedule, but the Tuesday of that week. That's 2 weeks from tonight, or 2 weeks from yesterday. If you have a conflict, fine. All the lectures in this course are downloadable, all right? And I expect you to attend even if you can't attend some particular night. That's part of the course. But obviously, as a courtesy to him, and because it's much easier to lecture to a live audience, and because I think it's going to be a very good lecture, try and make the time, try and show up for that Tuesday night course. I would appreciate it very much. All right, so I think those are the preliminaries. And tonight we're going to do mostly historical stuff, but we're going to do historical stuff like social scientists, using it as evidence that lets us think about the present. And right away, I'm going to confess to you that the approach I take, which is a very common approach in the social sciences, this is generally the most efficacious one, is I'm going to assume that terrorists are rational actors. All right? And the elephant in the room is that they keep doing things that we strongly suspect are irrational. So my favorite example is a bunch of German terrorists took over the German embassy in Stockholm in 1975, and they called themselves, I kid you not, the Socialist Patients Collective, because they were all former patients, mental patients, of a Hamburg psychiatrist who, in the best tradition of the 1960s, believed that they were victims of society, that they wouldn't be crazy except that they lived in a capitalist society, and therefore that the way to get in touch with their feelings was to have violence against the capitalist society, and that this violence would cleanse them of the mental illness which capitalism had given them. Should I mention that they screwed up the explosives and one blew himself up and another got so startled he bobbled the grenade and it didn't work out well? But, you know, the idea that mental patients would like to get involved in terrorism as a growth industry is sort of inconsistent with the rational actor hypothesis. And there are other aspects of this. The same German terrorists, also the IRA, had an awful lot of prison suicides. You know, I personally think that suicide is often a rational existential choice, but that's a minority position in our society. Any mental health person would say, oh, yeah, I could have fixed this person, right? So there is a suspicion that maybe there's a little madness. And then, no offense, guys, terrorists in all times and all places have basically one constant demographic. They tend to be under 30. And in fact, the Russian terrorists at the turn of the century were out of high school, a lot of them. This looks like a phase, for whatever reason, that human beings go through. And that, again, I suppose, is inconsistent with the rational actor hypothesis. In fact, the older you are, the more willing you should be to die, right? So I can't do much with this sort of dark forces theory of terrorism. I contend that nobody can. But I tell you it exists and that I know it. I do have some justifications for going ahead with my rational man model anyway. The first one, as I said, is it's powerful, all right? And you should use the tools you have, because if they explain something, that's great. And you can push the sort of dark parts you don't understand into a corner. The other thing I would say is that there's such a thing as evolution. And economists in the 1990s came up with beautiful theories of how the internet economy works. I guarantee you, when you go talk to people in Silicon Valley, they are only dimly aware, if that, that these theories exist. Nevertheless, they follow them. Why? Because people who consistently do irrational things go broke. They get defunded. It's not necessary that people have a very clear idea of why they do things for the rational actor model to work. And so what we're going to do for most of the talk tonight is we're going to talk about rational theories, bearing in mind that the actual terrorists may be somewhat confused. But I will also say that there is a record for the various positions that people take. It is clear that people thought in some muddled way that they were following these various strategies that I'm going to present tonight. So Let me just spend a minute about the dark forces issue. What could it be if it's not a rational actor? And I won't get very far into it. The thing we say now, every time you turn on the news, is, oh, they're Islamist terrorists. Okay? There were, by the way, Christian terrorists in Chicago. The Haymarket bombing was done by a Christian who believed in some sense that he would atone for the sins of the world. You have to be very Christian to believe that. And said from the gallows, today is the happiest moment of my life. Right? Very Christ-like. So there have been fanatics of other stripes. But I think that's too easy, because if you really just want to say, oh yes, they're Islamists, anything that these people do, we can just say, well, I predicted that. Or rather, it's consistent with my theory. It explains too much. It's not falsifiable, as Karl Popper, who we will get to in a minute, most famously said. So I want to avoid doing that, and that's why this lecture tonight will stop in the 1980s. We will talk about mostly terrorists who were avowedly secular, who didn't particularly care about Islamist issues, and you will find that their behavior is strikingly similar to the guys you see on the evening news. A variation on the their Islamist theory was Sigmund Freud, who got incredibly depressed, as he should have been after the First World War, and announced that mankind had a Thanatos complex, which is a long Greek word for we all want to die secretly, right? Heck, it might be true, but it has very little predictive power. I can't use that, right? So that's the kind of theory that people will raise in this subject. Since it has no predictive power, I am now going to skate by it. I will tell you a theory that gets a little bit of the way into this sort of irrational world that I find appealing. It was originally invented for totalitarianism, and you're welcome to sort of think about this and take it or reject it. I find it suggestive. This is as far as I can go in trying to explain sort of the idea of a non-rational theory of terrorism. And the Karl Popper, the same philosopher who invented this idea of falsifiability in science, wrote a long three-volume treatise about totalitarianism after the Second World War. And he said, you know, all through human history, there have been two broad classes of philosophers, because after all, to a philosopher, all of human history is about other philosophers. And the one kind are materialists, people who say, you know, what I see is what I see, and I build my philosophy on things that, you know, are solid, and I worry very much about I think, therefore I am, and those kind of questions. And the other people, the dangerous people, right, let's load this, is the people who followed Plato. And Plato, as you recall, had this vision of the cave, where all we saw were shadows on the wall of the cave, but the real world was inaccessible. There was this world that cast the shadows. There is this meaning underneath things which is not accessible to us. This is, of course, what religion believes, right? But it's also what Platonists believed, and following the 19th century, the Romantic movement believed, that there is this deeper meaning beneath things that is not accessible to people who just kind of look at the world and say, what you see is what you get. And Popper noticed, and this is what makes the theory very suggestive to me, he had just finished the Second World War, and Hitler was a failed painter, right? And one of the things that he did, which was sort of normal, was he had all these elaborate models of the great buildings he would build in Berlin with the Thousand-Year Reich. Okay, that's sort of normal megalomaniacal dictator behavior. But what he did that was very strange and very suggestive and very capital R romantic was he then commissioned drawings of what these buildings would look like in ruins. Right? This is very strange. This is Percy Shelley country. I mean, you know, Hitler didn't have that kind of artistic sensibility. He was in this tradition that somehow thought that, gosh, you know, he's a capital R romantic in a very twisted, awful way. He believed that there were things sort of beneath the surface of mere material things that were going on. And, of course, Napoleon did everything for glory and derided the English for being a nation of shopkeepers, right? Those darn materialists across the channel. I take great comfort in the fact, by the way, that in every modern conflict, the materialists had shown more talent for violence than the romantics, right? We put the Napoleons and Hitlers in their place traditionally. So that was Popper's idea, and romanticism is indeed celebrates these rare, radiant individuals, and to have the somewhat crazy belief that my actions as an individual can change history is capital R romanticism with a huge underscore. I mean, most terrorist groups have 12 guys or 100 guys who are active, an outer size of these things of 1,000 guys. To think that they're going to change history takes a touch of megalomaniacalness, and romanticism is very congenial to that because it talks about these special individuals who are so bright and geniuses and beautiful that they change history. As I say, I have a hard time getting in touch with my dark side, and I'm going to leave it in a minute. I do want to recommend for people who think that this is suggestive W.B. Yeats' poem, Easter 1916, about the Easter Risings. Yeats spent his life hanging out with IRA people. He was in love with a woman who was completely fanatical, and her husband, she didn't marry Yeats in the end, her husband died in the Easter Rising, or rather was executed afterward. And he writes this terribly complicated poem. Yeats said he was the last romantic. I would suggest that only a romantic could suggest that they were the last romantic, right? But what he said was, which is the flavor of what I'm trying to leave with you, the famous line from the poem, and by the way, later in the poem, he's too smart to buy it entirely, so it's an ambiguous one, but the place where he puts the case best for the romantic vision of terrorism, of political violence, is this famous line about a terrible beauty, that he hung out with these people who were sort of comical, and he would meet them, and he would talk to them a while, and thought before I had done of a mocking tale or jibe to tell around the fire at the club, thinking that they and I but lived where motley is worn, right? Who are these comic relief characters? They're just small people. All change, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. The people and the nation are transformed, are cleansed, become different because of violence. This is facially crazy. You get locked up for believing this stuff. But this is the closest I can come to what the dark side of terrorism is. The human instinct, you know, humans manipulate symbols. If you take the world and you put it into symbols and you do manipulations on them, you're an economist. You know, you're making mathematical models of the world. If you love symbols so much that you manipulate the symbols and expect reality then to track what you've just done, you're a voodoo practitioner, you know, sticking pins in dolls. Humans believe this about symbols. Symbols are seductive. That's the closest I can come to the dark side. We now go to the rational models. Okay, so like three-quarters, nine-tenths of you, I went to see Tom Cruise over the summer, and I was astonished that Steven Spielberg would love H.G. Wells so much, so I read some H.G. Wells. And the second book I read after War of the Worlds was The Invisible Man. And I don't know how many of you have read it lately, but it's a comedy about terrorism. All right? So this immediately tells us two things. It tells us first, you know, anybody can write a novel about some obscure subject, right? To write a comedy, this subject must be coming out of the audience's ears. And indeed it was. Western Europe was hysterical about anarchist terrorism in the 1890s. Wells is writing a comedy about that. So it shows that really very similar to discussions to the ones that we have now were rife in Western Europe 110 years ago. So that's the first thing you learn. But the real pleasure of the book is, well, how does comedy work? Well, almost all comedies are based on dissonance. And what the central joke of Wells' book is he sets up this logical argument, and Wells has a beautiful logical mind, and he sets up this logical argument that's obviously untrue, and the reader has this dissonance and laughs as a result. So what's the argument? Well, about halfway through the book, the invisible man, a guy who's figured out a way to make himself invisible, by the way, Wells hints is a drug addict and an unpleasant person and probably deranged, starts announcing that he has a simple plan to rule the world. He's going to tell people what to do, and if somebody doesn't do it, he'll kill them. And since he's invisible, see above, everybody in the world will do what he wants. Okay? And he then goes into this sort of maniacal laughter and starts saying he'll be called Invisible Man the First, and anybody who doesn't call him Invisible Man the First, there will presumably be a second, right, will be immediately killed. And it being a comedy, and I think this is also Wells' judgment on the logic. It's a good argument, right? I mean, if I'm invisible and I can kill people, they'll do what I say. It's not obviously wrong. So Wells' argument, then, is pretty good, but of course the Invisible Man gets, you know, tries to take over an English village, and that's a lot too large for him, and he's sort of killed immediately, and there's no big deal. But that's sort of the nature of the book. And a large part of the lecture tonight and tomorrow is exploring Wells' argument. Because, as I say, he has a beautiful logical mind. It doesn't really... We can sort of make arm-wavy protests. We know it's wrong. But why it's wrong is worth exploring. And, in fact, terrorists have been busy trying to explore why it's wrong. That's not how they would look at it for the last 110 years. So I think we'll go to the next slide. And what I want to do tonight is I will push very hard on compiling a list of goals that terrorists have historically used just to justify their actions. Why do I think terrorism will work? I will try and make some estimate of how well these goals have actually worked out, and we'll make some comments about how the state has responded and how effective that has been. So there are antecedents to terrorism. There's really nothing much resembling modern terrorism until the 1800s, but there are some intriguing antecedents. My favorite is there was a Roman in mythology named Gaius Mucius, and Rome, as usual, was being threatened by its neighbors, mainly because Rome was always causing trouble. And some large army of Etruscans gathers under a king named Lars Porsena, and this army is about to destroy Rome, and Rome is puny in those days, and there's nothing they can do. So Gaius Mucius to the rescue. He sneaks up on Lars Porsena with a big knife, and he jumps on him and is about to kill him when he's wrestled to the ground. And Lars Porsena says, you know, that's not cricket, old boy. And Mucius turns to him and says, yes, well, you can kill me, but there are another 1,000 Roman youths like me, and they're just going to keep coming, so you ought to lay off, go away, take your army away. And this, of course, rescues Rome. But to punctuate his point, Mucius sticks his right hand in the fire to show that he really is sincere and burns it to a crisp. And this is the part that makes the Etruscan king particularly scared. I can see how that would be. And since, just to show you, this is not part of the course, but to show you that the Romans were an utterly humorless people, Scaevola means left-handed, because for the rest of his life he was, in fact, left-handed. All right, so that's an old idea. There's a similar idea in the time of Christ, roughly. There was a Judaic sect called the Sicarii, who were basically a resistance movement and killed a lot of Romans and even more collaborationist Jews in Jerusalem around the time of Christ in order to eject the Romans from Jerusalem. This would sound terribly modern, except that they believed that when they killed the last collaborator, God would sort of tear apart the heavens and reveal himself to everyone and kick out the Romans. That last part doesn't fit the rational man model very much. And finally, of great influence in the Arab world, there was this sect called the Assassins who lived in what is now Iran. And basically, they didn't want the Ottoman Empire to absorb them. And they wanted the Ottoman Empire to understand that if they did try to absorb them militarily, which militarily wouldn't be much of a problem, this is a minor sect, that a lot of people would die. And so they became famous in disguises and assassinating people. And, you know, it's this guy that you hardly notice but suddenly kills some mayor of some caliph in some palace somewhere. And, you know, it's customary to say that terrorism doesn't work and that these are sort of stupid strategies, and so it's customary to say the Assassins failed. I would point out that, you know, there's 200 years of Assassins here for a little sect that sort of angered its neighbors. They did all right. The modern form of terrorism, originated not with terror by individuals but by the state. And in the French Revolution, people discovered that, you know, I can terrorize individuals, right? That's not particularly smart. That's what the Sicarii did. But in the French Revolution, people discovered that I could do better than that, that if I just randomly arrested people and invited people to denounce people and I executed a lot of people without asking for a lot of proof, my enemies would be so terrified that they'd never get organized. All right? And in the 20th century, people like Stalin, you know, made a huge deal out of this. At 1.2% of the Soviet Union was in a gulag somewhere. Everybody was denouncing their neighbor, And, you know, there was a certain sense in which you, if you had a plot against the regime, you know, your chances of getting caught were no better than anybody else because everybody was going to jail for plotting against the regime. Nevertheless, it's a wonderful way to put down plots against the regime. And so this phenomenon of a society that's completely terrorized was an invention of the French Revolution. Terror became reified. You began to think of terror as a political phenomenon rather than I'm going to intimidate this Roman governor or that Arab caliph. And as I say, I'm not going to do much more about this, but this was also the era of Romanticism, which produced the ready-made language for these beautiful, rare individuals who would go kill tyrants. Anything you read in Shelley ends up with some golden youth killing a tyrant. Since Shelley died when he was 27 or something, this may have information about the psychology of terrorism. And finally, in the 19th century, if you had an idea sort of floating around in the air, there was always a German philosopher ready to write it down. And so there was a guy named Karl Heinzen who wrote a treatise on terrorism before there was such a subject. And he said things like, the terrorist must have completely no emotions, and what's more, we should have prizes for better poisons because the ones we have really aren't up to the job. And he wrote down sort of a whole intellectual textbook for terrorism before there was such a phenomenon. The other thing that happened in the 19th century was technology changed. And terrorism has always been a marginal strategy, and therefore people always look to new technologies to say, you see, now it'll work, right? Because it's always been implausible in the past. And in the first part of the Great Age of Terrorism, people did things with black powder, which is not a particularly good technology. You see these bomb-throwing terrorists in Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons mostly, or in Microsoft Icons, you know, the big iron ball with the fuse sticking out of it. It was a pretty crummy technology. If you wanted to kind of try and kill the Tsar, this iron ball with the black powder in it weighed about 60 pounds. It's not a real good murder weapon. And to blow up a wall, which some Irish Fenians did in 1867, as part of a famous jailbreak at Clerkenwell Prison, you needed 500 pounds of the stuff. So it wasn't a real convenient weapon. It was the best they had. They were enthusiastic. But boy, when dynamite came, they were very excited. Because, you know, dynamite is just a much better technology. And there were whole political economies that people wrote about. This is great. Dynamite makes everybody equal. As if there's even one pissed off citizen, no government will survive. 10 pounds will blow up a battleship, yada, yada, yada. The story was oversold, but there were people who, you know, believed that dynamite was a political principle, basically. And my favorite is there was a magazine in Brooklyn that came out every week by some radical Irishman that was called, and I quote, "The Ireland Liberator and Dynamiters Weekly," right? Because this is the new age of dynamite. And then, of course, there were revolvers. The interesting thing about technology, even when you had dynamite and revolvers, was that terrorism was almost always suicide terrorism, right? We think we invented that, but we think we invented a lot of things that are actually very old. Certainly when you had to use a knife, which a lot of 19th century assassins, even after dynamite, did, you had to get up close and personal. The odds were overwhelming if you didn't blow yourself up with the bomb. My favorite is three Fenians sailed under London Bridge with a big barrel of black powder, and it went off prematurely, and they never found the parts of any of them, right? But even if you managed to hit your target, you were sure to be captured, and you were sure to be executed. So there is a sense in which there's nothing terribly novel about suicide terrorism until basically the Second World War. The technology wasn't very good most of the time. Okay. So the first wave of terrorism, I'm going to, you know, anybody who puts things into waves or patterns for you is oversimplifying, but then again, you can't follow the story and neither can I otherwise. There are basically three waves of terrorism in my and most people's telling. The first one is from the 1870s to World War I, and there were basically three theaters of that. One was in Russia, one were the anarchists, mostly in France and Italy, also in Spain, and then some sort of provincial terrorists that presumably the other terrorists looked down on as bumpkins in Ireland, America, and the Balkans. The second wave started in the 1960s, and some of those groups are still around. And the third wave then is the Islamist terrorists, which we're going to leave till next time. Okay. Russia was a very sad situation. You had this intelligentsia, which was very small, who believed in Western ideals and wanted to have a Western-style democracy. You had this Oriental, that's meant to be an insult, it was a 19th century insult, this oriental monarchy which just did what it pleased, and you had huge numbers of workers and peasants who could care less. And so you had this very frustrated intelligentsia, the people who ran businesses and such, the students, who wanted to do something, but they felt very helpless, and they didn't know what else to do because the Tsar wouldn't give them anything resembling any kind of representation. And they had gone through the Napoleonic Wars, and all these people admired the French and Western Europe, and they wanted to be like them. And year after year, they would plot, and there was a Decembrist plot to take over the government. All this stuff failed. And, you know, for 40 years, they knew there was this better way. They hated being in Russia. They wanted to reform the place, and they kept being frustrated. And what happened in the late 1870s, was an organization arose called People's Will of Terrorists. And it had about 500 members, about 50 of whom actually did anything in terms of what we would now call operations. That's a reprehensible word suggesting that terrorism is somehow similar to the military. But in any case, and that's a very common pattern. If you look at modern terrorists, those are just about always the numbers for all of these groups. And they lived in this thing that is historically anomalous, that practically everybody within their circle approved of them. And in fact, the situation was so desperate that some of the terrorists were liberal Democrats. They weren't even socialists of any stripe. And they kept telling the Tsar, look, if you would just ease up a little, if we could have a little bit of representation, we'd stop. And in fact, when President Garfield was assassinated, they said, no, no, you got us all wrong. Terrorism is legitimate in Russia and nowhere else on the face of the planet. In America, you can vote. Anyone who kills a president is evil. And they would do things like, you know, they would catch a police spy, and the spy would tell some cockamamie story about how he wasn't a spy. In the 20th century, we understand we liquidate that person, got to be sure, right? Well, we learned a lot of nasty things in the 20th century. And in the 19th century, they didn't look at it that way. And they had a lot of trouble with spies, precisely because they could never come up with the nerve to actually liquidate the ones they were doubtful about. And they would start to attack the Tsar, and they would see that his children were nearby, or they just couldn't go through with it. You had this spectacle of a woman named Dora Brilliant who said that it was much easier to die than to kill, and she must have been right, because she tried to kill the Tsar and paused at the last moment, couldn't do it, but she was very brave on the gallows. And that was sort of the nature of this. There was widespread, it's not like Dostoevsky at all, there was widespread admiration for these people. And they killed a few people. They assassinated the Governor General of St. Petersburg, the Tsarist political police chief, and ultimately, on the third try, Tsar Alexander II. And they believed that in 2 or 3 years, they were on record, they started off optimistic, why not? In 2 or 3 years, if they killed maybe 15 people, it'd be a lot better than a big bloody uprising, and that ought to be sufficient. The government would collapse. So what did they think they were doing? Well, the first thing they said, of course, is I've impressed on you is that they had no other choice. Well, that's not a reason, really. That's not an affirmative reason to do something. But it is a recurring story about terrorism, that people are driven to strategies that even they understand are marginal because they have no other plausible way to accomplish their goal. What they then said, for a positive reason, is, well, it's a revolution. We're going to destroy the government. We're going to replace the government. And the destroying part, you know, you could argue about, but you do the experiment, right? If you kill 15 people, it doesn't collapse. Well, I guess, you know, how would you know that in advance? But the replacing the government argument, they had a lot of a hard time with, right? Because, okay, suppose I destroy the government. Something else is going to come in its place. I would like this Western liberal democracy, but I have this giant country where people basically disagree with that or don't even understand what those words mean. You know, I'll have some mess that is just as bad as the government I collapse, maybe more reactionary, right? And this bothered them a lot. So their first offer was, they said, well, you know, people will follow our example. If we're brave and noble and we kill government people, then other people will imitate that because, you know, this is the best form of convincing people. That didn't work very well for them. And after a while, they just got around to saying, hey, it's our job to destroy the government, and somebody else can replace it with something better. But it's a question they never really answered, right? And this goes on through the history of Russian terrorism. And then the last thing they said is they would repeatedly tell the Tsar, after they blew up Tsar Alexander II, 10 days later, they write a letter to Tsar Alexander III, and they say, you know, it really doesn't have to be this way. If you would just have a little bit of democracy, you know, we could stop. And these people were sort of the most decent terrorists in human history, so you almost believed that that would work. So those were sort of their goals. And then, of course, once you get into this business, the police rough you up and you want to go kill a policeman. Your comrades are being tortured in jail. You want to go have jail breaks. And after all, there's a price on all these people's heads. So once you get into the game, it sort of continues regardless of whether you see that the goals are futile. The results were awful, right? There was some hint at the beginning that maybe they would get a few concessions, but what actually happened, particularly after they killed the Tsar, was the government turned even more right-wing than it had been before, and it had massive repression. That repression was effective. It got rid of people's will, and the government, all they had done in the end was make life worse than it had ever been before. And the way that the government got them was informers and spies, right? They just solicited people, and this turned out to be incredibly effective. You know, you just get some guy to say, hi, I'd like to join People's Will. And they were riddled with informers and spies. The arrest came fairly early, actually, in the 3 years or so that they were effective. And you learn two things from that are kind of paradoxical. The first one is that the organization was destroyed fairly early in terms of coordinated action, coordinated conspiracy. The second thing you learn is that the pieces of the organization, the individual human beings who had once nerved themselves up to the act of going out and killing members of the government, were dispersed and continued to cause trouble. And in fact, there basically was no People's Will left by the time that they did succeed finally in blowing up Tsar Alexander II. So this teaches you that the state will ultimately win, and we'll see lots of examples. But this teaches you the state will ultimately win. But on the other hand, once the organization is crushed, it doesn't necessarily mean you buy peace. You're going to have violence for a long time afterward. And this has been a pattern that tends to recur, that you can, the violence may be less organized. Organized violence is particularly dangerous. But something that's relatively simple in our day and age, leaving time bombs around, this is something that some yokel in the woods can do. The Unabomber taught us that. That kind of violence is hard to stop. And once the organization, you know, formally you've shredded it, but if you don't get every single person, and you probably won't, you know, you can expect that the violence will go on for a while. Okay. The next era in Russia was around the turn of the century, and there was a party called the Social Revolutionaries. And within the party, and this is something that's very typical of revolutionary parties, they had a secret sub-organization, which they called their combat organization. The IRA does this, right? They have the party, and then Sinn Féin, and then within that they have this secret organization that does military stuff, as they call it, terrorists, as the English call it. So the Social Revolutionaries had this combat organization. They were very professional. When they would scout victims, they would dress up as coachmen and go undercover and conduct elaborate surveillances. And they were also, like all terrorists through human history, very technology enthused. One of them heard in 1996 that there was such a thing as an airplane, and he immediately wanted to have one so that he could, you know, commit terrorism. And they also, this is not something they invented, it had actually happened a little bit with People's Will, started doing expropriations, which is invariably bank robbery. And in October of 1906, there were something like 300 bank robberies in Russia, all of them for political purposes. And they pulled down $5 or $10 million a year, which was great for promoting the mission, but also brought a lot of criminals into the organization who sort of paid lip service to the terrorism, but were really enthusiastic about bank robbery, which is you can't get good help. This continues to be a problem for terrorists today. So through 1904, they succeeded in killing several ministers. Plev was actually the so-called strongman of the regime, other than the Tsar, the top guy. So they certainly were effective in an operational sense. 1905, the numbers spike up a lot, but there's a trick there. Russia picked an idiotic war with Japan and got their head handed to them, and this showed the whole country that the Tsar was weak and incompetent, and this causes trouble, right? Even if there had been no Social Revolutionaries, you would have had a lot of trouble. And so you have a few years of really massive government disorder, and then it tails off. But even in 1911, the last year where they were relevant, the next strongman was killed outside the opera house. So, you know, the fact that you get these guys and throw most of them in jail doesn't mean that you're home free. And how is that done? Well, pretty much the same way. I think the lesson here is that even as Russia was really on the ropes from fighting with the Japanese, but they still, if this is a game about who can terrorize whom, the state has many more resources in terms of arrests and rewards and the ability to make people paranoid and put spies all over the landscape so that nobody trusts anybody when they talk. The state does a much better job of terror than terrorists do. Did this mean that the state just ignored them? No. The ministers were terrified. They had this wonderful quote, all ministers are human and they want to live. They didn't get a lot of work done. They spent most of their time fussing about the terrorism threat. Government was very inefficient. But when you killed a minister, there were plenty of people of about the same competence in line for the job. So it shows that the state is very, very resilient, and that the idea, you know, that if I kill 15 guys, then the state will collapse, was pretty optimistic. How was the terrorism put down? Well, there was this ambitious second in command of the combat organization. The first thing he wanted to do was to be top in command, so he denounced his boss to the secret police and got the top job and was in pay of the secret police. And also, of course, was sort of one of these double agents who wasn't particularly reliable for either the secret police or the social revolutionaries. So it went on for a long time. But there were lots of informers inside the organization basically from the beginning. And the scale of this thing is worth noting. It's quite small and naive by Stalinist standards. But the Okhrana, which was the political police in those days, had 26,000 paid spies in the country doing nothing but making life miserable for these social revolutionaries and others of their ilk, and 50,000 policemen busily keeping files and occasionally arresting people when they figured out who was doing what. Or, I would point out, when they figured out who might be doing what, because the whole point of this game is that you're not particularly particular about who you arrest. Now, the Marxists, the people who ultimately ended up running the Soviet Union, thought all this was fairly nonsensical. Marxism believed that it had a science of history. Physics is the science of physical objects, so it has basic units that it talks about, atoms. Economics has basic units, firms. And for Marxism, the basic units, and if you only had a theory that told how these basic units behave, you could understand all of history and predict what the capitalists would do next, was classes, the proletariat, the bourgeoisie, the governing classes. And if you have a theory like that and somebody comes to you and says, yeah, yeah, but me and 12 guys will just kill these 16 guys and then the government will disappear and everything will be great, this is anathema, right? I mean, there is no such thing as three guys in Marxism. There are classes and class interests and the class will take care of itself. So there was this bias. Nevertheless, terrorism is seductive, and Marx would occasionally try and make special excuses. And in particular, the only terrorist, the thing that drove Marx crazy, the thing that drove the Soviets crazy, was that you had this theory about how there would be revolution in the most advanced countries of capitalism, but where did revolution actually happen? In this backwards place, Russia, right? Well, you don't want to give up the revolution. You kind of want to be that a triumph of Marxism, but it's not what you predicted at all. And so what happened was that Marx would say, well, you know, Russia's a special case, and there can be revolution even though the country is not ready historically. And it happened that Marx had an Irish radical wife, and so it turned out that about half the time Marx would also say, well, you know, Ireland isn't developed, but there too there's an exception, that terrorism is good in Ireland. One can't help but disentangle it. You know, his wife had long discussions with him about Ireland. And Lenin said, look, this is all a diversion. You have to be able to replace the state with something, right? This is the critique of terrorism. And what is that? That is me agitating, educating, propaganda, parties, mass organization of the people. Because otherwise, you knock down this government, some even more horrible government will show up. And after all, the evidence favored him on that. So Lenin was very opportunist. He didn't mind, you know, he wasn't a prisoner of ideology. If you were having a war with somebody, if you're having a civil war, terrorism would be good on the side. It might be useful. He wasn't going to, you know, put it off the table. But the idea that you could accomplish things primarily in terrorist mode was anathema to him. And the nicest summary of what conventional Marxism always thought about terrorism, thought into the 1970s, right, and a reason that most Marxists were a little leery of terrorism, that terrorism wasn't encouraged that much by the Soviet Union, was from Leon Trotsky, otherwise on the outs with Orthodox Marxists, who said the classes whom the state serves will always find new men. The mechanism, the state, remains intact and continues to function. Far deeper is the confusion that terrorist attempts introduce into the ranks of the working classes. Confusion? Well, not really confusion. What he meant was people hate terrorists. And, you know, the idea of people running around killing people at random, the proletariat should welcome this, but in fact, in most times and places, they don't. And it's very difficult for honest Marxists to go and organize the proletariat when other people are blowing up policemen. And so he viewed it as mostly counterproductive, which is the usual Bolshevik rule. And the last wave of terror in Russia was against the Bolsheviks themselves when they took over in 1917. And they attacked the Bolsheviks, of course. They also attacked the Germans, because the Bolsheviks' big plank was to make peace with the Germans, get out of the First World War. Neither of these things was very effective. The Bolsheviks were hanging on to the state by their fingernails, but that didn't keep them from arresting everybody in sight and torturing people and doing what they had to do to get rid of terrorists, and it was crushed in short order. And the other thing that happened was the German diplomats understood that, yeah, there are these crazies running around, but if I can keep the Bolsheviks in power, my goal, which is to make peace with Russia so I can go beat on the Allies on the Western Front, is going to be achieved. And if I lose a few German diplomats in the process, well, good men are dying every day in the war. One comment I want to make is you see a lot of sort of vague talk in the television about asymmetric warfare. And the idea somehow there is that the terrorists have some advantage because they're small and nimble. That's not the advantage. The advantage is that Western states won't do certain things. The Bolsheviks had perfectly good ways to deal with terrorism. If the state is allowed to exercise the full breadth of terror, it has always outcompeted terrorists. The West won't do it in most cases, and that's the asymmetry 9 times out of 10. All right, so just to review, what did they think they were doing? Well, we had 3 efforts to destroy and replace the state. None of them came close to destroying the state, and as for replacing, nobody ever came up with a very credible story about why that would happen. There was some effort to obtain concessions from the state, but the state went heavily right-wing long before reactionary, long before they got around to giving concessions. There was this talk of blocking peace talks, but the Germans were too smart for that. They knew that the point was that the Bolsheviks had to win. And finally, there's this idea of inertia, that once you become a terrorist, even if you later figure out it's a bad idea, well, these people want to hang me, I guess I'll keep being a terrorist. Countermeasures were liberalization. Nobody ever seems to try that, but, you know, terrorism is this last resort. Gosh, maybe if I lighten up, things will be better. Informers, censorship, what's the point of doing terrorist acts if they don't get in the newspapers? If there were terrorist acts in China today, would we know? Mass arrests, if you're not too particular about whether you catch a bunch of innocent people, you probably have a much better chance of catching terrorists too. And internal exile, that you can send them all to Siberia, which is always a popular option in Russia. In the West, there was anarchism. There was actually an International Anarchist Congress. Can you imagine, like, trying to have order on the subcommittees? And the police liked this anarchist thing because it made the police look important, and the police could ask for all sorts of powers. And so they always played up the anarchist threat. In fact, not surprisingly in retrospect, I said terrorism is mostly about groups. Groups are dangerous. Anarchists are poorly suited to forming groups. Most anarchist violence is by individuals, which is much less effective. Give you a sense of it. In France, a man named Ravachol was upset that the French government machine-gunned 14 people during a May Day rally, mostly women and children. And for this, he went and bombed 3 houses, well, 2 houses and a barracks. No one was killed by him, but the public wasn't particularly upset about the government machine-gunning people. Hopefully that's changed. But they were very upset about Ravachol, and immediately he was turned in by a waiter, which is like adding insult to injury, right, that the proletariat would turn on their benefactor. But, you know, there was horror that people would do this. And 2 years later, a guy named Vaillant tried to throw a bomb in the Chamber of Deputies. It was a good dynamite bomb, but it still weighed too much, and his shoulder was jogged, and he mostly blew himself up, but he did live long enough to be executed. And the next thing that happened was that the French Parliament, who he had tried to bomb the day before, the French Parliament never agreed about anything. This they agreed about, and they all voted to pass legislation to make anarchism criminal, to restrict the anarchist press, to increase the size of the police force, and give them big surveillance powers. And the next year, French police, New Year's Day, had made 2,000 raids on a single day, and, you know, weren't too particular about whether they got people who weren't core terrorists, but let's get all the sympathizers, built a huge database of everybody who might know something, might be part of this, made a lot of arrests, and was very effective. And it wasn't on a Russian scale, but apparently it was sufficient. What did the anarchists add to terrorism lore, right? The main thing they did was there was something they called propaganda by deed, which is important in our own day. We have this idea that if a person is willing to die, or even willing to kill, that's strange, but if a person is willing to kill, he must have a good reason, right? Now, I personally think this is deeply confused. When I have an argument with some idiot in a bar who holds extreme views, I don't question his sincerity. I just think he's wrong, right? And in fact, historically, people who've been willing to kill and willing to die have included every political stripe. People used to admire the Nazis in the 30s because they had so many bright young men who were willing to die. Okay? It's a bad argument. Nevertheless, down to the present day, humans have this huge dissonance about terrorists. And how could some PLO guy on an airliner shoot the stewardess? He must have a really good reason. We want to believe this. And so there's this testimonial effect about terrorism, which down to the present day has a lot of cuts a lot of ice with people. I don't think it's logical, but, you know, we can talk about it. And what happened? Well, in France, people like Zola, just as in Russia, had been very sympathetic to terrorists. I don't like this regime much. These people are trying to change the world. Their heart's in the right place. They may be confused. But when they started killing people and throwing bombs, that ended pretty quickly. And, you know, the invisible man isn't really invisible if he's a terrorist. He's invisible because there are people who might notice things or might know that he's a terrorist who don't turn him in. And when those people start to sympathize with the state, he becomes a lot less invisible. And so the idea that, you know, this waiter, if he was in Russia and it was the people's will, he might not have turned in the terrorist. But in France, after these atrocities, as they were called, it's a good word, we should bring it back. After these atrocities, they did turn in the terrorists. And so the terrorist was constrained in his violence, that he couldn't do things that would lose public sympathy because the game was up, he would cease to be invisible. And as I say, the other thing that happened, which is completely typical of all terrorist outbreaks in all times and all places, is that legislation was immediately passed because the public was in a mood for it after these atrocities. And the police get surveillance powers and mass arrest powers. And the fact of the matter is, they aren't extreme by Russian standards, not even by 19th century standards, but they're enough. And so learning from this, the anarchists, for about 50, 60 years, said, well, you know, we believe that if government would go away, everybody would make nice, and it would be a great society, and everyone would be happy. But I'm ready to live in that society. I don't know about my neighbors. They need to be educated a bit. It's unreasonable to think that somebody throwing a bomb and destroying the government will get this paradise that I'm talking about. We need to have education and propaganda and all these things that Lenin's talking about. Because really, it's not reasonable to think that, gee, if I can only destroy the government, everything will be hunky-dory. The comeback to that for a while was, well, you know, there's propaganda by deed, and the anarchist leaders would say, yeah. You can show by example that you can throw bombs at the government, but this says very little to people about how they will live once the government disappears. And so there became this idea that, look, you have to prepare the world, and just throwing bombs is not going to achieve your goal. What you'll end up with is more repression, and if you're unlucky, a really worse regime. Okay, so the big contribution here is we're just adding to our list publicity and propaganda. And the new items, the old items here I put in purple, the new items are public opinion gets mobilized against terrorists, police surveillance, big databases of sympathizers, and criminalizing advocacy. The first thing the French did was they made anarchism illegal. So if you advocated anarchist terrorism, you went to jail too. So these are all reasonably effective measures, at least they were in France. Okay, finally, periphery. Ireland, of course, has been having risings against the English for all time, but certainly since the Napoleonic Wars, there was this Clerkenwell prison break where they put the 500 pounds of black powder up against the wall of the prison, killed 10 people, bystanders, and were immediately hated by everyone in England, including the large Irish community that had previously been supporting the Fenian terrorists. They were called Fenians in those days, and started turning them in. So that was sort of the big Irish attack in England in the 1800s. The Fenians also assassinated three heads of the British government in Ireland as they were walking through a park in 1882. Did it with daggers and were immediately caught. These technologies were not that good. And the British put up the extraordinary sum of 10,000 pounds. Can you imagine what that is in 1880s dollars? I mean, just amazing. And they started hiring informers like mad, and the Fenians always had large numbers of informers in their organization, and the British basically controlled the problem pretty quickly on that basis. The Fenians also did something which was natural for Irish revolutionaries. They'd done it during the Revolutionary War. You look to see who England's big opponent is at the time. In the 1900s, it was France, it was Germany in the First World War, and it was Russia after the Second World War. And you say, can I be your friend, and can I have some support? And the Fenians opened negotiations with the French, but that was about as far as it went. In the U.S., we had mostly labor terrorism. Strange thing. We would have some labor dispute, and people would start dynamiting the boss. And the examples were the Molly Maguires, who were terrorists in Pennsylvania. In all times and all places, coal miners have been very dangerous. Why? First of all, because they know explosives. Secondly, because their life isn't worth much anyway. They're going to die. I mean, it's a very dangerous, nasty occupation. They are always the malcontents. So there was terrorism among Pennsylvania coal fields. There was the Haymarket Square bombing in Chicago, where somebody threw a bomb amongst a lot of police. There was labor dissatisfaction with the governor of Idaho. They assassinated him once he retired. His name was Frank Stunenberg. Labor thought that they had voted somebody friendly into office, and the first thing he does is he sets up the National Guard as strikebreakers. And there was the Los Angeles Times bombing in 1910, where apparently, it's still controversial, but apparently the perpetrators thought that this would discourage scabs if they just set off an explosion next to the Los Angeles Times as part of a labor dispute, and the place burned down. So, you know, you got to be better with explosives. And there was quite a bit of this violence. Between 1905 and 1910, there were about 100 bombings in the United States, and coincidentally or not, iron worker wages doubled in that time period. Cause and effect, you tell me. It never really got into the mainstream American political economy. It was always among immigrants, and it was always economic. People didn't seem to want to bring down the government particularly. And that's a puzzle. In Spain, there was anarchist violence, but increasingly it was labor violence, also to sort of improve negotiating positions. And eventually, the labor violence became criminalized to a large extent, and it became about exploiting, forcing workers to pay union dues, which were promptly siphoned off to bad places, kind of like our labor organizations in the 30s to a large extent, when the communists were the only labor unions around. In Armenia, there was an interesting idea. They thought that if they committed terrorism, it would draw attention to the fact that the Armenians were oppressed, and the powers of Europe would lean on the Turks, who in those days were called the sick man of Europe, right? They had very little capacity to resist British pressure, say. And Armenia would get more independence. So we had one bright morning in 1896, they invaded the Bank of Constantinople, held the place for 3 days. And unfortunately, the Christians were a minority even in Armenia, and what happened was there were then 3 days of massacres that followed, and the European powers did nothing, and there you are. So that was a bad idea. And in the Balkans, the most famous, biggest consequence of terrorism in history, right, is they assassinate Archduke Ferdinand, caused the First World War. The idea was, among the terrorists who did it, that, gee, he might come up with concessions and give Bosnia a little bit of more liberalization, and we got to prevent that because what if the people fall for this dastardly trick? It appears that the most terrorists and the Russians who were a sponsor of this group desperately tried to say, don't do this, you'll start the First World War. But did they listen? No. Okay, so we'll wrap this up. The points in black are collected from the Russian era and earlier stuff. We now have three new items. The idea that you can force people to withdraw from occupying your country. This is the Ireland situation. The idea that it might be a good thing to keep the government from giving too many concessions, show the people how nasty this government really is, which is the idea that the people at Sarajevo had when they killed Archduke Ferdinand. The idea that you can bring in foreign intervention if you commit terrorism, and the idea of economic demands. Countermeasures, public opinion again, offering rewards, a £10,000 reward was hugely effective, informers, and mass reprisals. This is terror in another guise. In Armenia, it's like, fine, you know, the response to taking over a bank is I'm going to destroy the, you know, your whole community. That puts everyone in the community very much on the side of making sure there's no further terrorism, right? Because it'll fall on my head is the idea. And that's where we're going to stop for our break. I'm sorry. Come back a little early. I might cheat on the 15th. Karnak, all right.
So, I don't think there's any more rights. I think 15 is just
oh, you mean nothing for the last hour? Is that why you were flagging me?
$16 million.
Yeah, all this stuff.
come on, we'll just adjust this.
It's a very nice way to do things.
I mean, in my own business.
trying to be with you.
I looked up. Are you in your house?
Is this going to be like general?
It's actually like somebody is a proper way to solve a problem in an apartment complex. So. I'm glad he's back. Virginity. This is my fun semester. No responsibilities whatsoever. I'm tired from everything.
Yeah. That should be good. I don't know.
Why?
It's just like, we walk around campus. Some people, and you're like,
want to
go with your friends?
No, I'm with your friends. What's really going on? I think the funniest thing about me is, because I was really good at the entire summer, so it's about getting used to being around your neighbors, and then like getting just annoyed when there's mobs of freshmen like getting down the entire sidewalk, so you jump off the sidewalk
exactly.
And walk.
Yeah, this is really good. I saw you last year. And that was, yeah, it was weird being like, not that night, but the car keys.
Do you have a car?
Yeah, I'm trying to find a parking garage. So, it's not really working. We have two spots in my place. Four or five of us. And my car got broken up 2 days ago.
And if somebody had it stolen. Oh, a parking garage.
The thing, I don't think it really matters if you're on the street.
Yeah, with a little opener.
Yeah.
Problem solved.
Surprisingly, it's still scary.
I don't know. I'm not so sure about it. Madison is cool. Like, there's all kinds of like cool restaurants and fun stuff.
No, man. Like, I'm.
You're leaving. You're going to do that. All right. Well, have fun working on the outside. Yeah. I always thought, frankly, this is just my personal thing. So maybe, but you remember you have to keep up the commitment, and it's not like you have extra materials to have what you want. That's true. It's probably viable, but I'm not frankly with you.
So can I start rounding people back up? Okay. Let's start wandering back in. Humor me.
Oh yeah. There's something like an airplane. It's just
it was cool. Somebody remind me at the end of the class to post the website again, because I know that went by pretty quick. So I'll put that up. If you get to that website and do what it tells you, everything else should follow from there. But really, you're cutting yourself off at the knees if you never figure out how to get on the wiki or whatever. Let me see. Okay. So moving right along, that was the end of the first wave of terrorism. There was some terrorism between the wars, well, from 1915 to 1960. but it was the age of mass parties. The communists had had a very definite idea that terrorism was a futile strategy. And the first half of the 20th century was all about huge monolithic parties on both extremes, the fascists and the communists. And terrorism was marginal to that. Both of these people believed with a vengeance what Lenin had believed, that organizing was the important thing, and that one or two people doing random violence might be useful, sure, but wasn't going to change anything. They had completely swallowed Lenin's dictum that, you know, it's about mass organization, about mass parties. Terrorism is a mistake, a dead end. There was some terrorism. All technologies get improved. The main change was that the First World War, thank you so much, delivered automatic weapons, and you begin to see that coming into terrorist plots in the 20s and 30s. And there was a lot of fighting in Ireland before the war was even over. They thought, as the Irish always do, that the British would be preoccupied. It was a good time for a rising. And when that didn't work, terrorism became more or less endemic, partly because they figured that if the British kept incurring casualties, they'd leave the place, and partly because the Irish really wanted to have a big guerrilla movement. And what's hard to remember because the Irish are European is that Ireland was the first colonial war, right? We usually think of colonial wars as taking place in the developing world, but Ireland was a colony, and they were the first people to do most of the tricks that later ended up in places like Vietnam and all the colonial wars of the mid-century. And what they noticed was that if there was a role for terrorism, it was because the British were so darn good at hiring informers. And so they directed their terror against the British intelligence services on the theory that if you killed them, they would be hard to replace. The British could always send more troops. And they made friends with the Germans, particularly during the First World War. And again, as the Second World War approached, there was some Irish terrorism, and the Germans were contacted as part of that. There was also terrorism between the wars in Spain and Portugal, increasingly labor terrorism, historically important for two reasons. First of all, that eventually the terrorism got to the place that both Spain and Portugal ended up with right-wing dictatorships, again, presumably not what the terrorists wanted. And secondly, that the culture of Spain and Portugal is intimately connected to Latin America, and so the idea of terrorism at one remove ended up in Latin America, where it resurfaced in the 1960s. There was terrorism against the British in India. There was terrorism in eastern Poland, Ukrainians wanting independence. There was an interesting form of terrorism in Japan, which was terrorism by one part of the government against the others. Whenever there was a liberal prime minister, he was assassinated. There were an extraordinary number of prime ministers who were assassinated in Japan between the wars, and we know which prime ministers were left, right? The ones who ended up starting the Second World War. So that was a very strange struggle between elites within the Japanese government and effective, but something that you just don't expect to see again, that one half of the government will be assassinating the other. And finally, there was terrorism in the Balkans. There used to be all sorts of jokes about, you know, Balkans is the best place for all flavors of terrorism. The interesting lesson, there are very few regularities in social science, but this is probably one of them, is that terrorism never got started at all in the many totalitarian regimes that sprang up in the 20th century. It didn't show up in Russia, it didn't show up in Eastern Europe, it didn't show up in China, and the reason was that the state was everywhere and these states occasionally practiced terror. And in that environment there was individual acts of violence, but there was very little terrorism. I actually have an odd counterexample which we'll get to in a minute. The big innovations, this was a quiet business, right? There wasn't that much terrorism around, but there were some innovations. State sponsorship became somewhat important. All these regimes had enemies who had fled at the time of the revolution, and they wanted to assassinate them. So there were a lot of Russians coming to France to kill other Russians. The Germans did the same thing. Italy also had very aggressive covert operations, as they would be called now. They had ambitions in the Balkans. They ended up absorbing part of the Balkans in 1939, and as part of that, they decided it was in their interest to assassinate King Alexander of Yugoslavia. They also funded the assassination of two anti-fascists, the Roselli brothers, in France, in Paris, in 1936. And they supplied enormous amounts of weapons and explosives to right-wing fascist groups in France in the 1930s. This is still small stuff, but it was unprecedented for the time. And Bulgaria was, for various forgotten Balkans reasons, always intervening in Macedonia and funding a lot of terrorism there. The big point about state sponsorship is that I've made this argument, it's more than an argument, there's a lot of evidence that we'll see more, that if we're going to play the terror game, the state can always do better. But if you have state-sponsored terrorism, if you have a haven outside the country, a place for these people to go, supplies to come in to solve a lot of their problems, then the state that is the victim of terrorism has a hard time catching these guys. If they can dart back across the border, they can relax and refit and hide, and they can get resupplied, and a lot of their problems are solved. Terror becomes much less effective, I mean, counterterrorism becomes much less effective when there's a base outside the country. And of course, terrorism has become more international. That's part of the story we're telling tonight. But that's a major development. When you start having state sponsorship and state havens for terrorists, it shifts the balance somewhat back in favor of the terrorists. In the 30s, and really through the 80s, it remained a marginal game. But it levels the playing field a little bit if there's a foreign government supplying, as they did in the 1960s and 70s, hundreds of tons of weapons and explosives, which the Russians sent the IRA and the Libyans sent the IRA. Trawler loads of stuff would show up off the coast of Ireland. At one point, they left 80 tons of plastic explosives. God only knows what the IRA could do with 80 tons of plastic explosives, but huge quantities of stuff from the outside. It makes it much harder to suppress terrorism if they've got a safe place to go. The other thing that happened was that there had been already criminal elements with the social revolutionaries, but in the Balkans, terrorism became a business, and they eventually sort of forgot whatever political agenda they had, or it moved to the side, and there were Macedonian terrorists whose main job was committing murder for the highest bidder, or narcotics trafficking. Once you create this organization with all these weapons and safe houses and the ability to do clandestine things, the temptation to turn it away from political purposes to making money is very tempting. And in Bulgaria, there were also terrorists who made $2 to $3 million in mid-70s dollars. This is, everything's normalized too. Committing extortion and also collecting money from the state. Bulgarian terrorists spent most of their time killing each other. It's estimated between the wars about 200 of them were killed, all by each other. So what was new here? Crime and state sponsorship. World War II. As I say, terrorism was marginally important in World War II. The big advances technologically, which we are still living with, is plastic explosive. You have to be a little bit expert to use dynamite. You can make mistakes. Things don't go off. That's true of plastic explosive, too, but it's a much easier technology. It's much more flexible. And the big improvement, much more than even plastic explosives, was timing devices. There were people who made sort of clockwork bombs, even going back to Napoleon's time, but they weren't terribly reliable, and you had to be pretty much a clockmaker to build them. What the Second World War did was it put the British to the task of developing really good timing devices, like the one they gave to the Germans who tried to kill Hitler in 1944. And once you have timing devices, terrorism ceases to become what it had de facto been, that every terrorist attack was also a suicide mission. It becomes much easier to just leave bombs and do that. There are other things that you might want to do as a terrorist that still aren't easy, but at least sort of the lowest rung of the ladder, leaving a lot of bombs around to blow things up, becomes easier because of this technology. I'll go over the history fairly quickly. The most famous example was The number two man in the SS was a man named Reinhard Heydrich, who must have made a lot of friends because he was called Hangman Heydrich even before he died. But the British dropped a team of Czech commandos who ambushed him and killed him. And in response, the Germans liquidated the entire adjacent village, teaching the villagers, well, all the villagers who weren't killed, that the next time you knew there were British commandos in the area, the first thing you need to do if you want to live is to go find German authorities. There is revisionist history, which I think is probably correct, that the British knew this was exactly what would happen, and that they wanted to do it because they were afraid that despite Heydrich's cute nickname, the Czechs might be sort of neutral about being occupied by the Nazis, and they believed that if they provoked a severe Nazi crackdown, there would be a cycle of violence and the Nazis would tie up their manpower occupying Czechoslovakia instead of putting people on the Atlantic Wall where the D-Day invasion was expected. There was some terrorism in the West, but it was very small scale. There were bombs in Paris movie theaters and things like that. Where there was terrorism or more often guerrilla activity, the Nazis also erased villages in France. They obviously didn't make the problem stop. It is a horrible expedient, but it was an effective expedient. And in the East, it wasn't even all that effective an expedient. There were armies in the forests of hundreds of thousands in aggregate of partisans. The Germans never pacified the places behind the lines. It wasn't safe to travel in sort of pairs of German soldiers. And as part of that, there was a lot of terrorism. And the German barbarism in the East was much larger than anything in the West. It was not militarily significant, the effects of terrorism. The Germans could live with it just fine, and you know, their methods were fairly effective. They did not make it go away, mainly, I think, because you had the ultimate state sponsors, that the partisans knew that the Russian army was coming and that the Americans would do airdrops to them to supply them and that there was hope. And the thing that kills terrorist movements more than anything else, good, bad, and indifferent terrorist movements, is the idea that I'm doing all this and I will die and nothing will change. And once they get that idea, that's where things start to become unglued. You know, it's all very well to have sort of the plastic soldier idea of guerrillas and terrorists, but in real life you have to persuade people to go up against machine guns. This is a difficult organizational task, and when their morale goes down and they begin to realize that this movement is futile, they start to drift away if they can. Okay. So, in World War II, the new tactics are provoking a crackdown, supporting conventional guerrilla operations. Terrorism, nobody has ever said, isn't a good thing if you have a big guerrilla campaign. What we're mostly talking about is terrorism instead of other options. But, you know, guerrilla campaigns routinely appeal to terrorism. They just don't think it's a substitute for mass military behavior. And lots of state sponsorship, in this case by the Allies. Countermeasures, there was a big reward for Heydrich's killers. It worked. Lots of informers. You see the movies. The Gestapo is everywhere. Censorship, you know, the Germans wouldn't admit anything in the newspapers. You had no idea what was going on. Mass arrests, they didn't much care if they arrested some people by accident as long as they got the ones they were after. Lots of surveillance, the Gestapo again. Military tribunals, what's the point of that? Well, military tribunals, by the way, you know, we had terrorists. We'll talk about them next time. The Germans landed two teams of saboteurs on the American coast to blow things up. And FDR said there was no way he was going to allow some federal marshal to have habeas corpus for these guys. We're going to try them in a military tribunal, and they were all but one or two hanged. The presumption is, first of all, of course, that, you know, why should we give them a platform to spread their publicity? But the presumption is that, yes, we'll give them a fair trial, but it may not be the same thing as that they would get in a federal court. And in Germany, one assumes that the fair trial was considerably less than a federal court. And, of course, there was lots of torture. That's what the Gestapo was good at. All right, so the post-war. The post-war was still the era of big parties and the mass-organized vision of how you do revolution. The idea was that there would be guerrillas in the countryside, and that the guerrillas would grow and control more and more territory, and eventually they would envelop the cities, and the country would then be communist in that era. There were places where that was clearly impossible because there were no forests to hide in, and the whole place was fairly small, and they would find guerrillas in a heck of a hurry. And now we're back to the traditional Russian justification for terrorism, which is, I have no alternative. And terrorism actually worked fairly well in a couple of places. In Palestine, the Jewish community, including Menachem Begin, blew up British intelligence again. They learned that from the IRA, killed about 100 people, murdered some officers that they took hostage. And the British said, to hell with it, and left. Well, why did they do that? This is a success of terrorism of a sort, but what you have to remember is not only were the British very tired after the Second World War, not in the mood for more wars and more casualties, but more importantly, they had never been in Palestine or the Near East for any reason other than to preserve the link to India. The strategic ability to send ships to and from India had been the strategic reason for the British to go into the Middle East. Well, India had been made independent in the late 1940s, and there was no reason anymore for the British to stay in Palestine. They probably would have left eventually, but it's true that terrorism hastened the process. And this is true of the other places along the British link to India, Cyprus, and Aden, where there was also terrorism. Probably the most influential terrorism of the 1950s was in Algeria, where at the beginning of the rebellion against the French, terrorists decided that they would do something new. They would hold territory. They would make certain parts of Algiers so dangerous for French police that the French government would effectively no longer extend to those areas. This worked with the police, partly because you could intimidate them, you could outfight them, and partly because they were corrupt and you could bribe them and find out what was going on. It did not work with the army. When the French sent in the paratroopers, that lasted about 15 minutes, and the guerrillas, who eventually won in the countryside in the approved manner of the 1950s, came into Algiers last, and that area which had begun the war was remained French until the French decided to leave, basically. And there was also terrorism ancillary in the good Marxist-Leninist way, ancillary to conventional guerrilla operations in Vietnam. They decided that one thing they wanted to do is get rid of all the village headmen who in each village helped support the South Vietnamese government, so they killed about 10,000 of them in all. And somewhat more interestingly, they also, like good communists everywhere, hated the Trotskyites. And it turned out there was a large Trotsky faction in Saigon. So the first thing that the North Vietnamese did was they assassinated a lot of those nasty Trotskyites. The communists always fought with each other and hated each other much more than they hated the capitalists. All right, so the goals there, adding to our list, is again forcing withdrawal. That's the various British things in the Middle East. Supporting conventional guerrilla operations, Vietnam, and holding territory is really the innovative one here. Okay. Countermeasures. For the first time, terrorists stood up and fought with regular army units. In all times and all places, that has worked out very badly. And that brings us to the second wave of terrorism. And I'm going to talk about three basic arenas, but first of all, what are the changes? The big one was television, right? There was actually a phrase in the 1960s which people took seriously called radical chic, right? I mean, this is like Marshall McLuhan and the medium is the message. It was cool to sympathize with terrorists in certain circles, and people would dress in sort of a way that showed sympathy with terrorism. Television obviously made the traditional goal of terrorism to get publicity and propaganda much, much more effective. And the other thing that coincided with that was that you had this odd thing that there were now airliners, and if you took over the inside of an airliner, you could negotiate with the government for days, right? An airliner is a peculiar space. There aren't very many public spaces where you can do that, but you could do it in an airliner, and this was a new technology, if you will, and that also made it easy to do relatively simple terrorist operations, which instead of going on for one day, could go on and on and on with lots of negotiations and manifestos being read and all this other stuff to play out this drama for a few days until the international press got tired of it. By the way, I said international press sort of reflexively. There is a quirk of our society, which is that we pay almost no attention to horrible events that happen in Africa and Asia and other places where we don't have the budget to send people from ABC News, or maybe what we don't care that much. However, if you do something in Washington, D.C., or you do something on an airliner, we empathize with that, or we have cameras that are close by, people could get enormously more publicity by getting onto the hijacking world stage than they ever could have in their home countries. It's true, for example, that in the 1960s, late 60s and early 70s, there were probably about 6,000 people who died of terrorism, all told. But at least half of those were in Ulster and in Argentina. Those people were effectively invisible. They got maybe the last part of the news. But these hijacking dramas, which, you know, ended up with two or three people dead, if that, you know, it's not that I'm not grateful, but that's what got all the airtime. And so there is this oddity of press coverage that international terrorism tends to be favored by, because that's what the big press organizations cover. Terrorists have traditionally always been, you know, 3 or 4 years behind the military in terms of acquiring stuff. And the IRA in the 1980s was already trading anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. And, of course, everybody was experimenting with truck and car bombs starting in the 1980s. So they went, ironically, sort of full circle back to the problem that people had hated before dynamite, that, gosh, now I have to lug 1,000 pounds of something up to my target. But, of course, in the late 20th century, you had all sorts of motorized vehicles. That was a lot easier than it had been at the Clerkenwell prison. All right, so I'm going to talk about three areas: Latin America, Western Europe, and, if we have time, international terrorism. The first place that this grew up was in Latin America, and once again, it was a traditional terrorist problem that all the old ideas for why we might want to do it was the old terrorist justification that we are terrorists because we can't think of anything else to do. There had been a rising tide of guerrilla warfare in the 1950s. There had been a lot of optimism, particularly in Cuba. But in the mid-60s, what happens? Che Guevara gets hunted down and killed. The guerrilla movements are in retreat pretty much everywhere. And so they need to think up something else to do. And they came up with this idea, which they called urban guerrilla, which was a big buzzword in the 1960s. But it started with Latin America. And the idea was, basically on the Algerian model, that there would be these people who would take over places not in the countryside that was remote, but in the cities, and that eventually this would grow and grow and take over these countries. The bands were actually rather large by traditional terrorist standards, mostly because they were tied to real guerrilla movements normally. The most famous ones were the Tupamaros, who started with a very small group of about 50, grew very large with a terrorist campaign, but they grew too large, and 3,000 turned out to be too big a number for security, and they were infiltrated, and that was more or less the end of them. Other examples are the Shining Path in Peru and terrorists in Argentina and Colombia. Most of these states got rid of terrorism in the 70s and 80s, but Colombia and Peru still have these organizations with them. Financing was state sponsorship, Cuba and the Soviet Union, and increasingly crime. So this is the era of narco-terrorism. It's estimated that the main Colombian terrorist organizations, or guerrilla organizations, if you will, I mean it's both, probably pulled down between $500 million and $1.5 billion. In revenues, basically by providing protection to the drug lords, keeping the government security forces away from them. So that's what I have to say about that. Just to give you an example, all these slides are on the web. You don't have to write down everything. Just to give you an idea that this is a pretty endemic problem in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, some of these places have, you know, a dozen terrorist groups, all of them with 100 guys or so, all of them with bombings and kidnappings and the occasional assassination. The urban guerrilla analogy, of course, didn't work. The Tupamaros decided for a while that they were going to create an alternative government. So they would have this part of town, and they would set up their people's court for people they didn't like, and they would kidnap those people, and they would have a people's trial. And then they had a people's jail, and they thought that they could do this sort of in downtown. And inevitably, this invisible man analogy broke down, and the government knew darn well where they were, and they came up against the army, and when terrorists come up against the army, it's not pretty. They also thought that they could take on army installations. They learned better. And what they ultimately did is they attacked foreigners, because remember, the invisible man is about having sympathizers, people in the country who prefer to look the other way, who give you a little help at the edges. And if you don't anger those people, they will continue to let you be invisible. And the best way not to anger them is to kidnap Yankee imperialist capitalist employees of oil companies and such, because nobody likes them much anyway. And it's when you start killing average people or even government people that you know, people start to turn you in. So their violence was modulated, largely, in the direction of anti-American sort of targets, because if they had gone after domestic targets, they would have had the traditional terrorist constraint that, gosh, my sympathizers don't like me anymore. Kidnapping, extortion, and bank robbery, and increasingly, as I say, drug trafficking and also protection to the drug lords. What's interesting about this is of the $500 million to $1.5 billion that people claim these large terrorist organizations make, about 10% of that goes back into running their guerrilla and terrorist operations. And the rest of this, like all good capitalists, is invested in stock and legitimate businesses and such. And what happens is, you know, it's very tragic with this is the tragedy of everybody's life, right? You start off as an idealist, and the next thing you know, you're running a corporation. So it does strange things for the terrorists. They start to obey market incentives rather than ideology incentives. And we will explore in this course, you know, how that changes the model. But they are no longer sort of, you know, I've been telling you this story about goals. And once money comes into it, you know, your goal can be anything. You go to work in the morning because being a terrorist pays a living wage. Okay, so the goals in Latin America, we've seen most of them before. Many places it was ancillary to conventional guerrilla operations. Crime entered into it, state sponsorship. The novelty was the idea that these guys could hold territory and attack military units. It wasn't terribly well thought out. But it did last long enough for the European terrorists to think, maybe we could adapt this model for Europe. Countermeasures, public opinion as always. The terrorists didn't do very well when there were elections. People weren't happy with them. And ultimately, the great catastrophe for many of these countries in Latin America was, where are the places with big terrorism? Well, Argentina and Uruguay. Uruguay was pretty democratic for Latin America. It was the most democratic in Latin America in the 1960s. What happens when there's terrorism is that the state asks for and receives more power. And in this case, they sort of achieved their goal. They did get rid of the Uruguayan state. They did get rid of the Argentinian state that they were struggling against. And what did they get? They got really ferocious right-wing dictatorships who funded death squads and all sorts of other unpleasant, nasty tactics. And they did it not just to get rid of the terrorists. They had their own agenda. It was a catastrophe for the whole society. But as part of that, they easily swatted aside the terrorists. When the state gets good and angry, it can out-terrorize the terrorists. So mass arrests and mass reprisals, right? You go and make people disappear, as they charmingly said in Latin America in the 1970s. Torture. And of course, whenever they fought with the army, they lost. European terrorism. So this was strange. In the 1960s, there was briefly a time, as you all know, we have sort of mandatory nostalgia at Cal, right, where it looked like the country was coming unglued, or it looked like it might come unglued down the line. And there were lots of riots and major civil disruptions. And out of that, a small part of that subculture began planting bombs. And there was a very large movement of the New Left, which, like the French intellectuals in the 1890s, maybe didn't agree with terrorism, but could understand how these were good people and misguided. And so what you got out of that was a large group of sympathizers, which make this invisibility thing work, and a small group of people who could pretty reasonably believe that terrorism was a sensible, not crazy thing to do. Why? Because all my friends are New Left, and, you know, they disagree with me, but I'm sort of in the same ballpark with them. It gives them sort of the psych comfort that what I'm doing is not completely abnormal and insane. We're herd animals, after all. It helps to have a lot of people who believe sort of what I'm doing. And the other thing that happened more or less at the same time was that there were not just leftist terrorists, but nationalist terrorists, and a lot of separatist groups in Europe sprang up. So again, just to give you an idea, all these people had maybe 100-odd people apiece, and they were all happily planting bombs in the 1960s and 70s and 80s. And some of them were leftist, and some of them were separatist, and some of them are around today, although all of them at a more or less diminished level. And that just gives you a sense. Here's the American groups, most of which we've long since forgotten. What basically happened was there was an outfit called Students for a Democratic Society, and they had lots of splinter groups that turned terrorist at one time or another. This won't surprise any of you, but practically any terrorist group you can name, there are two facts about it. One is that it formed as a splinter group from some other organization, and the other is that it gave birth to multiple splinter groups, often violently opposed to the original organization. Apparently, they're not sociable animals. So the three examples I want to talk about, the ones that got the most ink in the 80s at least, in the 60s and 70s at least, arguably, are the German terrorists, who were originally called the Baader-Meinhof gang, after Joachim Baader and Ulrika Meinhof, kind of a Bonnie and Clyde figure, did a lot of bank robberies and jailbreaks and that sort of thing. The Red Brigades in Italy, and the Irish Republican Army in Ireland, although I'm going to talk about their campaign in England because that's a more pure example. Basically, what happened in Northern Ireland was they had a civil war with the British Army around to keep the whole thing from spilling over entirely, but it looks much more like a military campaign than any kind of terrorism. So the Baader-Meinhof gang was very small. They spun out of this New Left movement. They probably had about 100 members at the peak, about 20 to 50 active members. And really, in terms of sort of individual jobs, bank robberies and such, it was usually, you know, five people or a dozen. And they probably had, but I mean, I'm going to apologize once and be done with it. Terrorism is so ubiquitous and the numbers are so shadowy that you have to take all these figures with a grain of salt. I could give you a footnote, but I could probably find a slightly different number. The estimate is they had about 1,600 supporters at the beginning, although disillusion set in. As the 60s waned, it became more obvious that, gosh, capitalism wasn't going to collapse. And as that happened, it's like you start increasingly asking, well, why is Baader-Meinhof doing this? And what would happen would be that conventional New Left people would say, you know, all you're going to do is bring the right into power. And they would start turning in the Baader-Meinhof people. So as that tide went back out, the Baader-Meinhof extremists were more and more left in their own world, and they couldn't really turn back. They had prices on their head, after all. But they became, you know, a smaller and more violent minority, and they had less and less of that sympathetic crowd that would hide them. Their goals were always rather vague, but as far as you could tell, the idea was that those nasty capitalist West Germans had persuaded the proletariat that they were actually a pretty good government and it was fun to live under them. But this was, of course, an imposition. It was a fraud. And you were going to unmask the capitalist system by making the German government show what it really was. And when that happened, the people would rise. And if this sounds like wishful thinking, that was remarked upon at the time. The results were pretty much negligible. Nothing much happened. They may have killed between 30 and 50 people over about 20 years of terrorist operations. This is, of course, small potatoes, as sad as it is, in the world of American murder rate, for example, which was 22,500 a few years ago. Financing, they did lots of bank robberies, and they had the East German Stasi giving them plenty of support for reasons we'll go into. The early history of this is that Baader gets thrown in jail. Meinhof breaks him out, which sounds really impressive, except when you realize that the West German government in those days was so liberal that they let him out with a single guard to go to the library so that he could research his book on radical communism to get his PhD. Anyway, so they get out and start committing bank robberies. Immediately, they start getting turned in and arrested, too. And what's interesting about the Baader-Meinhof example is that the arrests don't really stop the violence. Periodically, the West German police announce, and they're right, that they've broken the back of the organization. But if the idea is that you're going to stop assassinations and particularly bombings, those things are fairly easy. And there are enough of them, and there are enough of them scattered, that destroying the organization doesn't really stop it in a heck of a hurry. What happens very typically is the terrorist wave of outrages gets the public in a mood for legislation. The legislation creates new police powers and also a special anti-terrorist unit. And that starts bearing fruit almost immediately. Meinhof gets arrested. Various people at the top level of the Baader-Meinhof gang get arrested. One of them goes on a hunger strike and dies. An RAF splinter group then assassinates a judge in return. This is a disaster as political theater goes, because people just didn't care about the hunger striker anymore when they realized that this judge had been murdered. Trial takes place the following year. They have one of their bigger successes. They kidnap the chairman of the Christian Democrats, and five terrorists get out of the country to Yemen. Notice the international dimension. For some strange reason, Arab terrorists and West German terrorists were friends in those days. And then these people from the Socialist Collective take over the Stockholm embassy. Interesting negotiation. They decide that they're going to kill two hostages. They do, and the government quits negotiating. We will see in a while with international terrorism, European governments have traditionally given in. When it's a threat to the European government, they aren't nearly that laissez-faire about it. They get tough. And as I say, the terrorists bungle the operation and kill themselves, and three of them are arrested. The rest of the hostages are freed. Meinhof then commits suicide in prison. In all of these suicides, there is a sort of urban myth, maybe even true, that the West German security services help them along on the theory, why hold these people in prison? We'll only invite more terrorism. I can't pass on that. I suspect it's not true, but I have no evidence either way. There are more escapes. They bomb a NATO airbase. About the most impressive thing they do is they kidnap and murder a union leader named Hans Martin Scheyer and kill him eventually. And then, as part of the Schleyer negotiations going on, their good friends in the Middle East hijack a Lufthansa flight to Somalia, which ends disastrously because the West German security forces storm the plane, kill one terrorist, and capture three of them. At this, Meinhof's co-leaders are so depressed that they imitate her example and kill themselves. And an interesting way to end the year, they start firebombing German holdings outside of Germany. This is the traditional thing to do. The state is very powerful. Let's go to other countries that don't care so much about cracking down on the Baader-Meinhof gang and do our trouble there. More assassination attempts, spectacular ones, but they fail. German civilians notice these guys have weapons in the woods, tell the cops, more arrests. They blow up, let's see. Oh, it gets so monotonous. So they continue to do this stuff through about 1990, and there are arrests all the time, and if you squint at the statistics, they're sort of going down, but the point is that it's a lingering disease. The capability to do really elaborate things goes away, but it takes a while for these guys to work themselves out of the system. And the thing I want to show you is the last part. So in 1997, the German authorities announced, really, the RAF, this is Red Army faction, Baader-Meinhof rechristened itself, is no longer a serious threat. And they say, you know, the sympathizers are all disillusioned. And besides, you know, these guys thought that they were, that communism was going to take over the world. Well, what happens in the late 1980s? Communism collapses. There is no East Germany to support them. This is a bad thing. Even if you're delusional, you notice that communism doesn't exist anymore in Europe. And you end up with, I think, this very telling admission. The one professional skill, the last thing that they have to with them, the last thing that leaves, is they know how to send press releases to Reuters. And so they officially send a press release saying that they are done, and they say, we are stuck in a dead end. All human organizations have a huge problem with despair. if you convince them that this is all a meaningless activity, that there's nothing that they can do to get their goals, they have severe organizational problems. They're not wooden soldiers. They won't march endlessly. Once you've convinced them that it's pointless, it really is over. Okay, so I think we've covered most of these. Put yourself in their shoes. Americans have this bad habit of assuming that everything is easy for terrorists and hard for us. The sense of futility is really difficult if you're a terrorist leader. You have to first of all, convince people to take casualties. You know, military units in wartime, in the worst campaigns of the Second World War, take 15 or 20% casualties over 3 years. You can't organize military groups to take enormous casualties where you go off in the morning and you come back and there's an empty bunk next to you every night. Okay? This is the air war over Europe. You can sustain enormous casualties, but it's hard. And to have a clandestine organization that convinces people to get up in the morning and go do these operations, and they keep getting killed and nothing happens, is a really hard thing to do if you're a bunch of 20 or 100 people, you know, hiding from the police and afraid that you're going to get turned in at every moment. Sustaining that is difficult if you're a terrorist manager. Think about their problems. So the casualties is hard, and the worst part is terrorism is a young man's game for whatever odd psychological reasons. We know this. So they have to keep replacing these guys. And it's sort of a good story to talk about the first generation of Baader-Meinhof guys that, well, you know, it was clear that the West wasn't going to crumble. But in 1970, you could still tell yourself stories. And in 1980 and 1990, you can't. And so why would anybody sign up for this? You could fool the first generation. After that, they have a price in their head. Fine, they'll continue to be terrorists. But getting new people is very hard. And one thing that's very interesting is symbolic failures. These high-profile terrorist operations, like when the Baader-Meinhof allies took the Lufthansa plane to Somalia, and all that happened for their troubles was they were shot up and humiliated, is a huge thing. No wonder the Baader-Meinhof people killed themselves in prison the next day. Okay? This is very hard to deal with. And in fact, you see this odd dynamic where sometimes terrorists will frantically go out and do a second operation so that the world won't laugh at them for the first one. And since the second one is done in a hurry, you can see there's a kind of dynamic where that one will be a little sloppy and the odds that it'll fail too is a problem. And so you end up having a clue, which we will get into more next time, that there is a certain fragility to terrorism. There is a speculation which I want you to be aware of, and you can take of it what you will. The data aren't really that convincing. But terrorism has a generational cycle that at 20-year intervals, people rediscover this invisible man idea and think, like all people do, that they invented it and nobody ever knew it before. And they go off and try the experiment again for all the old discredited reasons because they don't know. It's not a bad theory, you know. It's a business of the young, and the young can't know the last failure of the terrorists, or they wouldn't do it in the first place. You see it in literature. As I say, you can sort of squint and see 20-year periodicity in some of this. I don't think it's that convincing. All right, the Red Brigades. This was in Italy. Italy has always had much more, well, a huge communist party, and much more radical population, therefore bigger population of sympathizers, therefore big surprise, the Red Brigades are more invisible and they have more elaborate operations. They had 50 paid members and various people who also did other kinds of agitation. Brigades, of course, as everybody who's ever seen an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie knows, is a gross exaggeration. Typical size is 5 to 6 members, which is true of pretty much all terrorist units that actually do terrorism. They maybe had 450 members in all and a huge number of sympathizers. Why did they think that terrorism was sensible? Well, the way they told the story was they were an armed avant-garde working within the proletariat to establish a party. This is like so radical chic, I can't believe it. But the idea was, again, the idea that they were an example. And if they committed terrorism, then other people would commit terrorism because they'd want to be just like the Red Brigades. And eventually the whole world would do this. And it sounds delusional to me, but you have to make your own judgment. And the other thing that they said, if you asked them, was they were going to destructuralize the capitalist economy, that they would make this torrent of goods which convinces those poor proletarian saps that the system is actually pretty good. When that was gone, the capitalist system would be revealed as a failure and nobody would blame the terrorists. They would just have the wool pulled from their eyes and suddenly they would love the terrorists and hate the government. That's their story. The results, again, nothing. A lot of excitement for about a decade. And they did extortion and kidnapping and such. A little bit about their history. What I find really interesting historically is the first thing that they did was they would kidnap factory managers and then bargain to improve the labor market. Now, you could say that's a rational strategy. It's a way of building sympathizers. All this is true. But there is a deep connection. The Molly Maguires and all pre-industrial terrorism in this area had this odd sense that, you know, they would intimidate the guy who owned the big farm to get bigger terms. They would show up in the middle of the night in costumes. This is where Carnival comes from. There was a certain negotiation that when it was viewed that the upper classes were pushing the joke too hard, that they were taking advantage beyond traditional rights, the redress in Europe for hundreds of years was that the lower classes would disguise themselves and bring out torches and threaten and write notes and all this. And the last place you see that is in Pennsylvania with industrial terrorism in the 1870s. This has that quality that we're not going to actually kill anybody. We're just going to kidnap this guy for a while, and this is how we make our point, and then we will release him. The problem is, of course, that that works in 18th century peasant communities. Modern life understands game theory, which tells you that every once in a while you have to kill the factory manager, which isn't in the spirit of the thing at all. And so there's this inbuilt escalation to more violence. But there's this odd sense in the early 70s that they're doing something that is almost theater, that the guy who's kidnapped isn't entirely worried. Maybe that's being overly optimistic. Anyway, it escalates, and they become well known about 1974 when they start killing people. There's some assassinations, and they get into big-time kidnapping, which is their specialty. Notice that kidnapping is a more difficult thing because you have to hide the guy than assassination, and certainly than bombing. Their big climax, and I think it's fair to say mistake, was they kidnap and later murder the former head of the Christian Democrats in Italy, Aldo Moro. And a very strange thing happens, which later also happened in Spain against the terrorist group ETA. The people come out and protest. Now, this sounds like theater of the absurd, right? That a million Italians come into the streets and protest terrorism. I mean, they're terrorists, right? Why do we expect that they're going to respond to this? And, of course, you know, I think you've heard my song long enough that this is hugely important because it's about sympathizers and who's going to turn these guys in. But what's really interesting in the case of the Red Brigades is that they internalize it. And some of them start saying, you know, we have lost the true way. You can't go around killing shop stewards. Those are the proletariat. You guys are out of touch with the working class. And so the place starts unraveling. Some of them split and others presumably inform. If this sounds repetitive, then we're both learning something. The Italian government passes pentiti legislation. Those who have repented, come in, I'll give you a small sentence, I'll put you in witness relocation, and as long as you give me more arrests, everything will be fine. And in fact, that year you get 360 arrests, for goodness sake. So they continue to kidnap people, but they're on the downhill slide. And then they have another one of these moral losses. They kidnap a NATO general named Dozier, and the Italian police use radio direction finding equipment to figure out where he is, and he's rescued. And this makes everybody feel that the whole exercise is sort of futile. The Red Brigades splinter, big surprise, and most of their leaders end up in jail. It dribbles on through the mid-80s, and they are still around, apparently, but they're about 50 members, and they're inactive. Okay, finally, the Irish Republican Army is different, right? They did have a Marxist wing. They split into nationalists who believed in nationalism and nationalists who were good Marxists. But I want to focus on their campaign in Britain, mainly because it's instructive for the current situation with the underground bombings. They have a high ability to do repeated bombings. A lot of the bombings are on the underground. The thing that's different about the IRA, again, because of various political constraints that we'll get into, the thing that's different in their case is that they are constrained not to kill too many people. And so you end up with high repetition rates, increasingly sophisticated attacks, and the IRA trying very hard not to kill too many people. Some is apparently all right, and apologizing even when, by mistake, one of their groups does something that's unauthorized and really too violent. It's an interesting dance. So they were always supported by donations largely from the U.S. We should be embarrassed about this, but we're the same country that helped the Fenians invade Canada in the 1840s, so what can I say? And as they occupied these territories in Ulster for year after year after year, they became more and more like a local mafia, and you ended up with bank robbery and money laundering and extortion along with their terrorist business. They had a large criminal business to fund it. Again, in Britain, the way the terrorism was done is they had groups of between 5 and 12 members, so-called autonomous service units, or ASUs, and a large number of Irish sympathizers. They would usually have 3 or 4 of the ASUs running in Britain at any one time when there was a big wave of terror. What happened, for those of you who don't know, is that the modern Irish troubles began in Ulster in 1969. There were various secret negotiations between the IRA and the British government, but that broke down, and there was a violent series of bombings in the early 70s, 50 and 60 bombings, and in 74 at least, 40 people killed. Things that should look familiar to you at this point but are worth noting: Ross McWhirter, I won't play trivia with this audience, Ross McWhirter is the co-editor of the Guinness Book, right? He's the one who invented the Guinness Book of World Records. And what he did, which terrorist organizations are obviously terrified of, is he announced a large reward for information on the people who are doing these bombings. That shows you that rewards are hugely important. If you're worried about the goodwill of your sympathizers and somebody tells them a quick way to make £50,000, that's keeps you up at night, right? Think about it from the terrorist standpoint. Anyway, what ultimately happens is that these guys would throw bombs through windows, and they would occasionally go out and shoot up restaurants from the street. And one of those went bad, and they got chased to an apartment where they were holed up for 6 days in a siege. And something very interesting happened, which we'll get to probably next time. But as soon as they heard that the special unit that takes care of terrorists was coming on the scene, this is after 6 days, right? Bang, I don't want to do that, and they give up. And this is a very recurring pattern. That's a mystery. I mean, we have this, as I say, Arnold Schwarzenegger idea that they just want to die so badly. And even consistent with that, there are various reasons why they really don't want this to come out to a firefight with the SAS. So things tail off, given both the police countermeasures and the state of negotiations in Ireland. You have this interesting situation in 1983 where they bomb Harrods. And this is considered, I don't even understand how you get into a world where some terrorism is worse than others, but this was considered horribly shocking and awful. And it killed 3 policemen and 3 civilians, which they did try to keep the casualties down. And the IRA solemnly announces that the attack was unauthorized and that it regretted the deaths. Thank you so much. The other thing it always tried to do was, to a large extent, maybe a third or a half of the time, target military families at least and policemen. But there you are. It's actually kind of reminiscent. I don't know if some of you have seen it in the paper. There's a scandal right now in Ulster that the IRA shot somebody that they thought needed shooting, and nobody has stood up to finger the people who did it, and this has become a big stink, and Bush didn't let the Sinn Féin representative come to the White House. So the IRA has learned something from its public relations, maybe not very much, and has offered kindly to kill the people responsible if that would make the family happy. I think they're unclear on the concept. All right, so this dribbles on into the 1990s. The thing to notice here is more technology than anything. They learn truck bombing long before Oklahoma City does, and they start bombing subways. What's really interesting is, except for one accident where the bomb goes off because it's badly constructed while the guy is taking it on the underground, you know, the IRA are sort of working people. They don't take taxis to where they blow stuff up. The point is that they start doing bombings on subways, but they don't do it on the subway itself. And they must have known it's so obvious. All of explosive technology, you'll learn this from Richard Muller in much more detail, but it's a simple calculation. You figure out what the blast is, and then you know you figure out how many people will be around, and that tells you immediately you want to find places where people are packed like sardines. The IRA almost entirely stays away from that. And in fact, they give warnings to clear the area, and sometimes they take advantage of the fact that they always give warnings to give hoaxes to sort of discombobulate the population. So the attacks, in some sense, become more sophisticated. They have many more pounds of explosives. They caused $500 million to the London Stock Exchange with a 1,000-pound bomb. But they don't hurt that many people, and sometimes it's pretty obvious that it's by accident. There's a photographer who's killed because he wanted to get the really best shot when there's one of these warnings. It's pretty clear the IRA didn't want that. Do they get blamed with it? I hope so. But nevertheless, it's pretty clear that they're simultaneously trying to be spectacular, and they're very sophisticated, and they have a high repetition rate of attacks if you're worried about, gosh, could this happen next Thursday and the Thursday after that and so on forever. But in the IRA's case, because of political constraints, they don't push that. And what happens then at the end of the period is... I like this in particular. There will always be in England. They send a hoax warning to the Grand National, and one of the royal family is evacuated along with everyone else. And suddenly, after 20 years of IRA attacks, the government says, now they've put themselves beyond the pale. When you interfere with horse racing, that's just too British, and you can't do that. The wind goes out of their sails. They would say they caused this, I suppose, when there's a political settlement finally. And it's hard... when 94% of the Irish Republic, that's the part of Ireland that's not part of England, votes in favor of a political settlement, and 71% of Northern Ireland, who are the people you're supposedly fighting for, vote in favor of a political settlement, to go on saying you're trying to free these people. But inevitably, this is the traditional problem for terrorists, The provosts, the people who have been doing these bombing all the time, immediately have a splinter group who do believe that they should go on making attacks. So something called the real IRA, you expect a trademark suit at any moment, announces that, you know, these other guys have betrayed the cause, and I'm going to go ahead with this. Now think about this from the terrorist point of view. One of the reasons, one of the more credible reasons of the long list of things that doesn't work about terrorism is the idea that I will extract concessions from the government. What does this tell you? This tells you that, well, yeah, but the government will look at me and say, you can't deliver all the terrorists. Oh, you might stop, but I'm still going to have to be dealing with the real IRA when you quit. I can't make a deal with you. Which means that whatever leverage they have to get concessions is discounted by the government. That's an inherent problem here. They can't credibly say that they'll make people stop. And, of course, from the government's point of view, there's an equally sophisticated judgment. They will occasionally say, yeah, there'll be a real IRA, but I'm willing to deal with that. I can make a deal that gets 80% of you people to stop. And what's more important, I can change the sympathy factor, and the remaining terrorists can be dealt with. You know, we have this idea when we have discussions about terrorism in the United States that we're going to make it go to zero. As a very wise college professor once told me when I was a sophomore, nothing in nature goes to zero, right? You probably won't get zero attacks, but if you can make them less sophisticated and you can make the rate go down, that's sensible. And so the British government made a very intelligent judgment that politically we can isolate the remaining ones, and the fact that we won't get all of them to abide by the thing that they signed, well, that's too bad, but it's the best we can do, and it's good enough. So the real IRA causes trouble for a while, and then an interesting sequel, which is there is exactly one bombing after September 11th. Why? because part of the IRA constituency is idiots, pardon me, I use that pronoun, in the United States who keep sending money to the IRA. And suddenly, terrorism isn't funny in the United States. And the IRA knows that to keep that constituency happy, it really needs to stop with the bombing. So that's an interesting item. And the second thing that happens is after the Madrid train bombings, we're implementing the Good Friday Agreement, and the IRA finally says, after dragging its heels for a long time, okay, we'll hand in the weapons. Now, whether that happens or not, I don't know, but there's a definite cause and effect. They are not the invisible man. The invisible man, to stay invisible, is constrained by a whole web of political factors, albeit in a tiny community of sympathizers. And to keep those people happy, to stay invisible, to continue to play this game, they are constrained in what they can do. That is the traditional face of terrorism, less so for international terrorism. We'll get to that. But that is a truth about this subject. Just because occasionally you have to be impatient with the rhetoric of destruction, you should put this in perspective. At the height of the Blitz, there was one very bad night. There were many bad nights, but there was one very bad night on October 15th when the German government came over and dropped high explosives on London. 540 tons of them. I will point out that in the calculus of the 20th century, not very much. The Germans were the romantics. Wait till the materialists started to work on Hamburg. All right? But it was a big thing in its time. It lit 900 fires and there were 400 dead. It did not cause the British to collapse. The modern state, for better or worse, is a very durable entity. Churchill was walking around saying, at this rate, the whole place will be a heap of rubble. He was not saying we would quit. So whatever violence has historically been possible with terrorism is very far down the road from what societies filled with people who are still, after all, alive and walking among us have put up with. It's just a truth about the subject. Other lessons from the IRA. This confirms what we've already talked about. They were largely persistent because they had a sanctuary in Ireland, in the Irish Republic. As long, that is, as they did not track too much crime into the Irish Republic, and their activities in England were not too violent. It was a constraint, because the Irish Republic would not tolerate this, and the British would not tolerate the Irish Republic tolerating if the level got too far out of hand. So that was one constraint. And we've talked about how crime made the IRA something less than the idealistic bunch of lads that they all set out wanting to be. It's interesting, as you look at that history, you can pull down these slides and do that, how the violence goes up and down over the years. One thing clearly is sometimes the British police would break these groups up very dramatically, and there were only two or three ASUs operating at any one time, so obviously if they take those ASUs offline, they're done for a while. It was also modulated to help their negotiations with the British government. There's an interesting and ubiquitous pattern in which some of it was done presumably because one faction of the IRA had to show that it wasn't soft because it had the other faction accusing it of being soft. And this tends to happen in Palestinian politics, which we'll talk about, but in all terrorist politics. Some terrorist goals are not about their ultimate goal, but just because, gosh, we're not the only terrorists around and we have to convince people that we're tough and mean and serious. I've mentioned already the problem that the IRA couldn't really promise to turn off the violence. And I've mentioned that there were at least three constraints on how violent the IRA could be. The Irish Republic, the U.S. population of Irish, and the Irish in Britain. Same thing happened in Britain as everywhere else. There was anti-terrorism legislation, the most famous example, both in the 70s and again in the 90s. The most famous example in sort of IT circles is that Britain has more television cameras in public places per capita than any other country in the world. I mean, by a large fraction. I think 25% of all the public TV cameras or something like that are in Britain. And of course, that was a nice inheritance for the train bombing, right, recently, that these things were in place and it made it much quicker to go find people. What I want to impress on you is that these seem like relatively small and ineffective steps when you look at this legislation and the things that government's put into practice. And in fact, you know, I'm a lawyer by training, and the discussion that lawyers like to make when something like this is introduced and you argue for either side is you say, well, what I want is a very small imposition and it'll have enormous benefits. Now, most choices in your life are not like that. You have a pretty big imposition and a reasonable but not huge benefit, and you make hard choices. But our public rhetoric is always to say, if you're against this sort of thing, well, you know, it won't do anything. Right? Because the kinds of little changes about I'll put in a witness protection program and I'll have a reward, democratic societies don't like having people spy on their neighbors. It's distasteful. So if you put in a little bit of that as part of the Italian legislation or in England or anything like that, you know, people don't like that. There's some resistance. And the way you defend against that is you say, it won't do anything anyway. A smart terrorist can get around that. Well, evidently, these things have bite, and I am not, notice, telling you how you should vote on this kind of civil liberties legislation. I am telling you you shouldn't delude yourself into thinking it's an easy choice. These are hard choices. You have an imposition, and you shouldn't. Your civil liberties are smaller. And historically, those things have been reasonably effective in European liberal democracies. This is a business of hard choices. It's not a business where, you know, gosh, it won't work anyway. That's usually an argument that is not based on evidence. So to tie this up, I want to talk about one more aspect of this, which is that all these movements in the 1970s were supported by the Eastern Bloc. And there were training camps, which you've all heard about, that ground 1,500 guerrillas a year through Eastern European training camps or training camps in the Middle East. There were summits that were hosted. 5,000 people got invited to Cuba, all of them from terrorist organizations, to figure out how they could improve their craft. And this sort of thing went on. There were bilateral exchanges between terrorists. It sounds like academia. In fact, there was a South American junta of all the terrorist organizations, and the first thing they do is they put out a journal called Che Guevara, right? Because you've got to publish in terrorism, right? You're nothing unless you publish your good ideas. You let intellectuals, they ruin everything. And there were these enormous shipments where they get trawler loads of arms. How did this happen? Well, the thing we forget is that it was probably tit for tat. After there were these enormous partisan armies in the Second World War, 25,000 of the Ukrainians just simply turned their guns against the Soviet regime before the war was over and continued to fight until 47, and there may have been some wandering around in the 50s, or that may have been a KGB provocation. In any case, we cheerfully dropped weapons to them in large quantities, right? 25,000 guys killing communists in Poland and especially in the Ukraine. We cheerfully did that. And all this is becoming declassified. We flew missions over Moscow where the planes came back with lots of bullet holes in them because we desperately had to know what they were doing. We had 15,000 nationalist Chinese periodically invading southern China in the 1950s. All of this is like, you know, you can read about this now. The CIA funded it because they thought, hey, it'll make the Chinese less enthusiastic about the Korean War. So in a sense, it was tit for tat. And it also looked about 1960 that, you know, Eisenhower and Khrushchev both looked at the Soviet growth rate and they thought, it's going to cross the American rate. There was a brief moment there where they thought that they really were the wave of the future and that they would outproduce us and eventually they would win. And in that moment, it might have made sense to start funding destabilization efforts. And of course, the Soviets always had a problem. They had to show that they were more radical than the Chinese and all the other people. They were not just a state, they were also the leader of communism around the world. And to keep that position, they had a built-in pressure to show that they were tough, and this helped. And finally, it's probably not accidental that the people in the Stasi who were busy, the East German police, who were busy funding Baader-Meinhof, were all really, really young. They sympathized with these terrorists, and they too could kind of feel what it would be like, and they wanted to help them. And the people who were old had been terrorists in the 20s. So there was a sense in which there was institutional inertia or a certain psychological predisposition. Maybe it wasn't so logical. The problem was the Soviet Union, meanwhile, had to do deals as a country. And so when it comes to Venezuela and says, you know, we'd love to have a trade pact, Venezuela would say, call off the Cubans. And the Soviets would, in fact, do that because Venezuela isn't going to have a trade pact with somebody who's funding guerrillas in Venezuela. And these people weren't very stable. The Soviets were kind of an old-line stodgy communist. And terrorists, after all, are trying to shake things loose in the world. They have their own ideologies, much more extreme than the Soviets. And it soon dawned on the Soviets that, look, even if these people won, maybe that wouldn't be so good. But, of course, the real problem was that they weren't going to win. They were going to lose. And as Trotsky had said, this will confuse the people. Not only when terrorism loses, people will think somehow communism has lost. And the conventional parties, which the Soviets really cared about, that were spreading the Soviet ideology and that were close to the Soviets, would be tarred with the same brush. And the Soviets had a horror of terrorism. And maybe it wasn't justified and maybe it was, but they believed that if you did this, it would spread to them. And finally, there was the embarrassing problem that once you started, you couldn't stop. The famous Carlos the Jackal went to East Berlin because it had the best nightlife, this is all comparative, of any capital in East Germany or the Eastern Bloc or the Middle East. You know, he would have preferred Paris, we think, but it was very hot for him in Paris at that point. And at one point, the French arrested his wife, completely unjustified. She tried to destroy a nuclear power plant. And he went to his East German masters and said, "Free my wife." And they said, "Why would we want to do that, right? I mean, we're not going to make a major investment because you have this personal problem." He said, "Oh, yeah? I'm going to attack the East German embassy in Paris." And they didn't really think he'd do it, but they had a problem. So they ended up staffing more security for the East German embassy in Paris to protect it against their own terrorists because they couldn't think of a good way to make this guy disappear, which wouldn't be a major embarrassment to the East Germans that, gosh, you're not so radical, you kill your own terrorists, right? So this is a problem. And predictably, what happens is that when you get to the era of detente and glasnost, the camps start shutting down in the Soviet Union, and the terrorists largely get defunded. Notice that there wasn't a chance the Soviets could fund terrorism all they wanted. The West was in no position to go to war over this. But at the same time, the Soviets wanted to cooperate at some point in their national life with the West, and that wasn't going to happen as long as they were running these kind of operations. What's interesting is how this changes the complexion of terrorism. Carlos is a professional terrorist, a largely new figure in the history of man. He does terrorism for a living. He started off for the PFLP, but he became freelance and started doing things mainly because the East Germans wanted it done, or because some terrorists in the Middle East wanted it done. And you end up with people in the, like Abu Nidal, who starts off killing PLO people because he disagrees with them, and the Libyans say, "That's useful, but could you kill a few of these dissident anti-Libyans?" And he does that, and he starts killing people for hire. Now, professionalization, as we know in economic life, is a good thing, right? And so, in a sense, this makes the whole terrorism business much worse, right? Because now you have professionals running around. And by the way, we have 20,000 Arabs who were in the Afghan war who now hang out their shingle as professional terrorism. So we have this with a vengeance. But at the same time, there's a certain sense in which it brings in new incentives, and we have to think through consequences of those incentives. But before we do that, I love this quotation so much that I'm just going to read it to you. This is the mournful romantic who says that terrorism is becoming so materialist, and he says, this is a West German terrorist, "When there is too much money, unnecessary things are brought. First a record player and a television set, then expensive suits and cars. And in the end, you look like something straight out of Playboy." I mean, you know, it's depressing. What was new? What was new really was not too much. It was the conceit of the Red Brigades and to some extent Baader-Meinhof that these guys could destroy the economy. They were obviously orders of magnitude short if they tried at all. But that was sort of the thing that they brought. Mostly they were warmed over Latin American urban guerrillas. Countermeasures, don't want to beat this to death, but you should. At the end of this lecture, we'll have a complete list for you. Public opinion is huge. When people offer rewards, it's a very strong lever. Informers are ubiquitous. and database kind of surveillance is a strong tool. And I think at that point we should stop for the evening. And if we have discussion or questions, we can do that. Otherwise, I have a couple of business things I want to mention. I will put up the website again. And you should all log on. Assuming I can find it. There we are. We should all log on, sign up for the email, because we will not be doing this through Telebears. We will be doing this through the UW website. So sign up for email, or you're going to wonder why I never write to you. And also sign up for the wiki, which is the online class discussion document, where we will do most of our class discussion. I will tell you that the quality of the wiki last year was great. People sit down in front of it and think about the problem, and they write very sensible things. And you get to interact with guys who are at Microsoft or at the national labs, or you know, computer scientists, and you really have very fruitful discussions, and everybody learns something about that. Yes, sir?
I just tried to pull up the website right now.
Sorry?
I just tried to pull up the website right now. It doesn't look to be working.
I don't think it's right.
To correct the link, you take off the last part that's current quarter. You just do CSEP 590, and then there's a link to something that says current quarter, and it turns out it's AU 05, Autumn 05.
The open source movement works. Yeah, it. Yeah, but you have the touch. Okay, so are there questions, or do we adjourn for the evening? Sir?
I tried signing up for the newsletter, but it says you need a UW email address.
Ed, are you listening? Let's do this. I have to tell you, it's been some time works and some time not for me, too. Let's do this. My email is smaurer, M-A-U-R-E-R, @berkeley.edu. So if you try something and it doesn't work, send it to me. We know that works. And I will send it on to Ed, who actually knows something about this, because we both know I don't. Is that a good procedure, Ed? Okay. Sir?
The book that you had on your syllabus, I saw that you had a link on Amazon, but is there anywhere on campus that we could buy it?
I didn't buy copies. There's certainly a lot of them. There should be a lot of copies around. It's recent. Basically, I didn't also do, because I basically trust you all, I didn't feel there was any point in me writing down particular chapters for particular days. I think it's a great book for supplementing the kinds of things we're talking about in this class. So if you order it from Amazon, I don't think you're going to lose anything in way of time. I would just go ahead and get it shipped to you. I think that's the best solution. Anybody else? Ed? All right, we'll see you next week.